Tonight on The Download, Amazon Chicago general manager Samantha Singer, Chicago Reader restaurant critic Mike Sula, and another installment of Touche with Chris Roebling and Dave Lundy. Now, here's your host, a man who is intent on teaching his cat how to podcast, Justin Kaufman.
Right? Who wouldn't want a cat that would podcast? It'd be the best podcast. Not the best. It'd be top 10. Okay, maybe top 20. Maybe in the category of cat podcasts, it would be top 20. But come on. I'll need some microphones. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Wow, I'm very excited to tell you this, Pete, but not going to believe it, but we got a cat. Rob Martiro loved this as well. After a couple of weeks of talking about it, this weekend we went and got a kitten. We named him Mr. Mittens, and he is right now taking over the bathroom in my house.
Congratulations.
Thank you, buddy.
Big step.
This is a big step. I'm excited and trying to raise a cat from kitten level will be definitely interesting. My son seems to like the cat. They seem to be bonding. The cat doesn't seem to be too scared. I hate scared cats. You know, like when your cat is like, when the kitten is too scared and you're like, didn't really do anything. Like, I understand like loud noises or understanding where you're at and, oh my God, what does that faucet do? I've never seen a faucet. But like just standing right there and being like, hi. And then like go and hide behind the toilet. Mm-hmm. Come on, get out of there. But we've got a good rapport. I get a lot of purrs in the first 2 days.
Aw.
The kitty likes me.
All right.
That's good, so. I'll let you know, but I'm going to be.
Wait.
I'm going to be honest. I'm going to be an honest talk show host who just got a kitten. I will tell you when I'm annoyed. You know, and I feel like I'm already getting there. Like I feel like, and I know this is terrible to say, but I feel like the pressure from the family. Like today, for instance, my wife went to work, my son went to camp, and there was all. You know, my wife just kept texting me saying, "What's he doing now?" I'm like, I don't know. I'm not in there. I kept him in the basement in the bathroom. That's where he's going to be. He needs some alone time.
The door wasn't closed. He could have, right?
No, he got to close the door. This is what they told us at the shelter. They said you have to, like, go room by room because our house is big enough that the cat will just go to whatever hiding spot we didn't even know about, and they'll be gone forever. Mm-hmm. I think it'll be bad Ronald for cats in the walls. So you're supposed to start in small rooms. But the problem we have is that we don't really – I have kind of like a loft house. Like, there's not a lot of doors. And so we're like, okay, so the downstairs bathroom is nice. So we set everything up in there for him, and that's where he goes. And we let him out, you know, room by room over the 2 day weekend to
get the feel of the place. Yeah.
So anyway, my thought is, yeah, someone 630 said, teach it to hunt rabbits. I know, I'm already ahead of you. I've done a lot of holding up to the window right there. See that? No, but. I will say that I'm excited to have the cat, but yeah, I'm not like the kind of guy who got a cat and now I just obsess about it.
Think about you're thinking about the cat the whole time.
Yeah, like I was just like it was so funny that my wife was like, "What's he doing now?" I'm like, "I don't know. I'm working. I'm up in the kitchen making coffee. I don't know what he's doing. I'll figure it out when I go down there. When set the alarm for when I'm supposed to give him food. Like I almost Aww. Like a, I'm like a prison warden." I go in there, I have the exact things I do, like purr, pet, scratch, toy, food, see ya.
This has the makings of a great made-for-TV movie. A hardened Kaufman doesn't really like the cat. The cat is not getting along with a hardened Kaufman.
Right. And then we solve crime.
Then you just fall in love, and you're inseparable.
It's like Turner and Hooch. Yeah. It's the same concept, but for cats. That's what we're going to sell. All right, we got a great show tonight here on The Download. We're going to get to it. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon tonight. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman. This is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the carryout. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Let's do the carryout. Here are today's top stories for those of you like me who glaze over on anything Trump-Russia. Here's what we know. The latest has the president's son, the slicked-back hair one, not the other slicked-back hair one. The president's son, Donald Jr., took a meeting at the behest of a Russian pop star during the campaign. President Trump allegedly didn't know about it, but the meeting included Jared Kushner and former campaign director Paul Manafort. Now, the Russian government says this crew had nothing to do with them, and I tend to agree. But the meeting was called because a Russian lawyer told them she had some dirt on Hillary Clinton. All right, you want my hot take? Is it time for my hot take already? Okay. I don't think this is collusion by any stretch. I think it was a normal thing to take this meeting. But then again, this is not a new investigation, so why is this just being revealed now? Oh, that meeting? Well, there was that meeting, but no other meetings with Russia. I mean, no. Oh, you mean the other meeting? Well, there was, yeah. I mean, that's it. That's the final. Yes, there's one more meeting. Right. I met with these people 600 times. I mean, seriously, why all the secrecy if you're not doing something shady, right? That's all. Once again, it's the cover-up. Seems to be worse than the actual thing. Jeez, today is supposed to be the deadline for bidders for the Sun-Times to have their funding secured, so that'll either be Trunk, who owns a Trib, or it'll be a bid from former Alderman Edward Eisendrath, who, like Jimmy from Goodfellas, says he's good for it. I'm good for it. And it turns out he is. Robert Feeder confirmed all the necessary money is in escrow, so are we good? I don't know. I don't know how this stuff works. Today's just a deadline, and you know what? This is the state of Illinois, so deadlines don't really matter. But the Sun-Times says that the deal is not secured soon. They will shut their doors, just completely shut down, which would be awful for Chicago because then we'd be forced to read our newspaper in sections, which is much harder on the train. Oh, and also the content. We missed the content, too. Really? Imagine all that paper everywhere in the metro, and you're like, I can't, no place to sit. Another violent weekend, although I'm guess not as bad as the weekend before. I lose track of what number means what anymore. 40-plus shot today. Two were shot, including a couple blocks from our studio. I was walking by the exact area right around the time of the shooting as well. Of course, I didn't know it because I was jamming the new Bruno Mars. Really great headphones. I guess that's the key to avoiding Chicago violence. Ignorant and oblivious. That's the Kaufman way. In the please don't be true category of news today, lawsuits have been filed against the U.S. Olympic Committee over a doctor who's being accused of molesting hundreds of gymnasts while the young girls were trying to make the Olympic team. What? No. The doc is expected to plead guilty to child pornography charges as part of the deal. He won't be charged with molestation. What? That can't be. Please don't be true. That's like, could there be any worse story than that? Tomorrow is Prime Day. No, not Optimus Prime Day. Amazon Prime Day. It's a later Prime. The Chicago area is celebrating by announcing more retail job losses. Sam's Club gets in the business, saying watch out for June losses, which will be out soon. Yeah, great. NASA's Jupiter probe will fly over the big red spot on the planet tonight. And for the first time, we'll get some close-up images of that big red spot. That's either a dried-up lake or an outdoor concert venue for Jupiter's version of the Dave Matthews Band. Hello, this is Jupiter Dave Matthews. Welcome to Red Rocks. In weather, it's hot and muggy and rainy. So hot, muggy, and rainy. And thunderstorms. Thunderstorm watch. Flights canceled, delayed. Check your phone. In sports, the White Sox and the Cubs limped into the All-Star break in rare form. The Cubs gave up 10 in the first inning. What happened to the slaughter rule? Don't do the slaughter rule anymore? Anyway, they lose 2 of 3 to the Pirates. They finish the first half with a 43-45 record. They're 5.5 back, tied for second with the St. Louis Cardinals. What? So let's sum it up. The Cubs are kind of playing like the Hawks do after they win a cup. Maybe they're kind of stealing that strategy every other year. Maybe that's the thing. But if you talk to any Cub fan, they'll say, nah, we'll turn it on in the second half. I mean, it's the Brewers. Yeah, but the Brew Crew took 2 of 3 from the Yankees this weekend. The same Yankees team that swept the Cubs right out of Wrigley. And say what you will about the Brewers, and I say plenty. Hate that team. But the Brewers are 9 games over .500, and they're challenging the Nationals for the number 2 seed in the National League. And to make matters worse, in my fantasy baseball league, Ben Zobrist and Addison Russell dropped today. Could you imagine that last year? And the league that I play in are all Chicago homers. They're the guys that pick. They're like, I like Junior Lake. Is he still around? those guys that keep picking up every time they bring up a Junior Lake. They're like, gotta have him. Mike Montgomery, a spot start, gotta have him. Zobrist and Russell dropped. Eek. On the south side, at least the Sox broke up the Rockies' no-hitter yesterday. I mean, they still lost 10-0, but at least they weren't no-hit. The Rockies took 2 of 3 and scored 26 runs over the weekend. And with that strong showing in Colorado, the White Sox end the first half of the season in last place in the AL Central and last place in all of the American League. Yay! Let's give it up for our rebuilding. We're not rebuilding. White Sox! Also, Chris Sale will start the All-Star game. Just to make matters worse. So that means you got 3 weeks to get each and every aging star off the roster to make way for the next generation. I want to see Todd Frazier in Milwaukee, Melky Cabrera back in Toronto, Jose Quintana on the Cubs, David Robertson to the Nationals, Derek Hollins on the Rockies, and James Shields to the Pulaski Park 12-inch league. Just for batting practice. And right now it's the home run derby on ESPN. That one game they promote like crazy, and then you're like, I'm not going to watch. I mean, it's got to be tennis on or something. Anything? This is the weekend where there's no major sport at all, so perfect time for you to reflect on your life and finally try to understand cricket. Although I guess there is summer league basketball. Bulls rookie Lowry Markkanen. Markkanen? Am I getting that right? Markkanen? Markkanen? Anyway, he wore a jersey this weekend that was misspelled. The Bulls misspelled their first-round pick's name on his jersey. Welcome to Chicago. We'll call you whatever we want to call you, okay? Also, D-Wade's coming back. And finally tonight, a black bear tried to eat a teenage counselor in Boulder, Colorado over the weekend. I guess he woke up as the bear was trying to eat his head. But I mean, to be fair, you're in the wilderness in Boulder, Colorado, camping under the stars. Isn't that part of the charm? Now they're going to hunt down that bear and kill him. It's like no one understands the rules of camping anymore. Feel bad for that bear. It's like, what'd I do? Thought it was a popsicle. Thought it was a push-up. That's the carryout for July 10th, 2017. Hey, if you like mayonnaise packets, you're in luck. We got a ton. And I don't think they expire. Wait, do they? Nah, you're fine. All right, coming up, Dave Lundy, Chris Roebling, Touche. We'll argue about whether or not it's a big deal. Donald Trump Jr. and Jared Kushner taking that meeting, some Russian lawyer. That's coming up right after the news. It's a download on 720 WGN. Stay with us. Rob Martier, how are you, my man?
I told you not to get a cat.
We went to the shelter. We fell in love with what was named Munchkins. Now we've renamed him Mr. Mittens Monroe.
You know what? I was just about ready to say, please don't tell me you named him Mittens.
Mittens Monroe.
Get so your son and your wife on the phone right now.
They're probably down in the room right now playing with the cat. Well. I tried to FaceTime the cat, and the cat did not care, which, come on. I mean, I was moving my hands, moving fast. I thought the cats like that stuff.
Good luck.
Yeah. I'll tell you all about it. I'm an open book.
I don't know. Yeah.
That'll be the quote. Hey, Rob said, I talked to Rob and he said, I don't know.
You'll have fun with it. It'll be fine.
All right. Good.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay. I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
It's time for Touche. That's right. Chris Roebling, Dave Lundy in studio tonight here on 720 WGN, as they are every Monday night.
Here we are.
Recap the weekend and, of course, the news of the day from our nation's capital.
Yes, sir. No, from Springfield. We've got a great new chief of staff, Christina Rasmussen.
That's right. We could do that.
Christina, wherever you are, we're pulling for you.
All right. So let's talk about this.
Magic fairy dust.
Donald Trump Jr., Jared Kushner, Paul Manafort meeting with a Russian lawyer.
You love the stories that start, there was a beautiful Russian lawyer speaking to a guy in a campaign. Let me tell you, having been to I have had the privilege of going several times, and Okay.
All right. So
here, I want to I want to start with this one because Mike Royko, who is really
who was not alive to see any of this,
the ultimate. He's looking down and laughing at all of us. But Royko used to have this great expression about Clarence McLean being pulled over and indicted in the Washington, the so-called Reform Washington administration. I'm a big fan of Washington, but it wasn't a Reform administration. And that was proven by Clarence McLean. And McLean, Royko said, the dumbest thing you can possibly do in politics, especially in Chicago, is take money from someone you don't know.
Hmm.
And Donald Trump Jr., whatever else can be said of him, and I think there's absolutely nothing to the story, nothing. But I'm a little disappointed that Donald Trump Jr. would listen to somebody he didn't know, whether it was about Hillary or Russian adoption policy.
Right.
You know, why are you listening to somebody you don't know, David?
So let's just review for a second. There's the story that they would like
try
us
to review.
No. The story they would like us to believe is that some distant acquaintance of Donald Trump Jr. picked up the phone, called him, said, hey, I'd like you to meet with somebody because they've got something bad on the Clinton campaign, on Hillary Clinton. And Trump Jr. said, sure, what the heck, and grabbed the campaign chairman and the president's son-in-law, and they all got together with somebody they knew nothing about and knew nothing about what the meeting's going to be. Are you kidding me? How dumb do we all look, people? Don't answer that, Chris.
I was going to say, with that new hair trim, that beard trimming thing you got going.
But seriously, the story doesn't pass the laugh test. You know, when the story first came out, Junior issued a statement. Within 24 hours, he had completely retracted the first statement and came up with a way different second statement. As with everything, what happened here? They lied about a contact with a Russian. How many times have we seen
this? Which is surprising to me they would do that. With so much swirling around this, you would think they would have come forward right away and said, here are the meetings we had. Here's the seven meetings we had. This was a Russian lawyer. Why is it we continually, a newspaper drums up some investigation of a meeting, and they go, oh, yeah, that meeting too.
I don't know.
You're a political guy.
I think it's kind of sloppy.
It's sloppy.
Are we not now among the many other superlatives that the Trump administration evokes? Are we now not saying it is absolutely number one for self-inflicted, you know, stepping on your own story, stepping on your own toes kind of situation? He scores own goals that distract from actual successes.
I know, or David, failures.
David doesn't
the
say there are any successes.
Well, I mean, this all again. It overshadows the story of the weekend, the story of the G20 and the meeting with Russian President Putin, Vladimir Putin
and with China and with Merkel. I mean, I think that notwithstanding what David is about to say, you know, Trump is actually, you know, proving himself to be pretty solid on the world stage. You have to give him credit for that speech in Poland, notwithstanding this ridiculous article in the Atlantic that talks about the core falsehood of the speech in Poland. The truth is, somebody has to stand up and say why we care. Why do we care? Why do we care about things? Either we're the folks who believe in freedom, liberty, individual, the status of the individual in society as opposed to the government, or we don't. And I think that Trump, it's not something that the liberals will agree with, but he gave a pretty rousing statement.
So, and here's the thing about the rousing statement. For about a year and a half now, every time Donald Trump finally gives a speech off a teleprompter, people go, wow, he gave a speech off a teleprompter and he didn't shoot himself in the foot. And it was he didn't shoot himself in the foot for a week. He didn't shoot himself in the foot for a couple of days. The half-life of the amount of time it takes to shoot himself in the foot and to step on his own message is shrinking. So he gave the speech. I don't think as much of it as Chris does and my right-wing friends, but that's okay. And he then had a press conference in which he bashed America at the press conference. And he bashed the free press, and he bashed his opponents, and he did this. And he stood in front of the repressive leader of Poland, who's been repressing the free press.
Not repressive.
Yes, he's been suppressing. You're right, not repressive, suppressing. He's been suppressing the free press. He stood next to him and bashed the American press. It's just this guy but the best. The pièce de Trump was when Donald Trump tweeted out that he and Putin had agreed to form this commission, a joint U.S.-Russian commission to study hacking of Russia.
Now, you'll hear the Sunday talk shows
and
the Trump supporters were out in force saying the Vladimir Putin has come out and said he had nothing to do with it. They're putting together this commission. This collusion falsity's got to go away. The proof is here. Putin said no.
I think that the collusion story had fallen probably a month or 6 weeks or 6 months ago, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, you know, all that the Democrats are left with on the so-called Russia thing is the possibility that there was some kind of, you know, cover up or some kind of misstep once the investigations got started.
No, I mean, false.
Well, I they just don't have anything.
You're ignoring the Wall Street Journal story where the GOP operative went and searched for hacking teams to find the worked with Russian hacking teams. Spoke in the name of General Flynn. You're ignoring that one. You're ignoring what just happened over the weekend. Come on, Chris. And you're not even defending with a straight face the fact that what Lindsey Graham referred to as maybe not the dumbest idea in the world, but pretty darn close. Idea that Russia, the guy who hacked our election, is the guy who's going to have joint commission.
The dumbest idea is that you can throw money at the Iranians and they'll be nice to you. And that was Obama's idea.
Nice deflection.
This is not anywhere close to Obama's missteps, mistakes.
It's coming up after the break, the rest of the top 10 dumbest political moves of all time. Yeah. Dave Lundy, Chris Rizrobling, let's take a break. And we come back, we'll put the collusion to the side and let's talk healthcare. There's talk of a new bill that's being rewritten that will be possibly voted on even by next week.
What about Illinois?
We'll talk Illinois as well.
What about Illinois?
We got plenty of Illinois talk. Okay. It's all over the place. Touche is special.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touche.
All right. Chris Roebling, Dave Lundy, continuing the argument throughout the break.
Next week we're going to do this at Howl and Hood before it closes?
That's right. It's closing here soon.
I hear it's closing.
End of the month, yeah.
Jeez Louise. I'm sorry to hear that. Kind of. I only ate there once. Maybe that's why it's closing. Did you ever eat there, David?
I did not.
You see?
Well, we got to the bottom of that. So.
It is the world's largest restaurant. Have you ever been in there?
I cannot
find the end of it. It just keeps going.
I don't know if this is a stall tactic to talk about healthcare. Like,
Chris really doesn't want to talk healthcare.
I'm dying to talk healthcare.
He's really into the restaurant that's closing around the block. Dave Lundy, Chris Roebling in studio. Let's talk healthcare. A rewritten bill seems to be surfacing, Mitch McConnell and Republican leaders. This is to essentially fold in more of the concerns of the conservative wing, Ted Cruz and others?
Look, I don't know what's in this bill, but this bill is toast. It is complete toast.
It's not even out yet.
I'm telling you, it's toast because you now have Capito, the senator from West Virginia. You've got Murkowski. You've got a number of the Republican women. Rand Paul, I think, maybe can be mollified.
No.
But, well, if Rand Paul can't be mollified and the Republican women can't be mollified, the bill can't be done in its current form. And let me just – I saw this poll today, and I'm just – this is kind of blows you away. The poll found that in a vacuum, voters in 10 battleground states are split almost evenly among Republican Senate candidates with 21 favorably, 21 unfavorably. When told that those candidates support the GOP healthcare bill, they go from 21 favorable to 20 unfavorable to 52 unfavorable, literally 31 points. And their generic ballot number drops 11 points.
Are you concerned about
this
the marketability
for
of this,
Republicans?
A Republican healthcare plan?
No, I think that if they don't, first of all, I think there will be a bill. Second of all, I think the various disparate forces will come together. They'll find 50 votes, and then they've got Mike Pence. And third of all, I think the bill will go over to the House, and I think the House will end up passing. We'll see a conference that passes 95% of what comes out of the Senate. I think that David is – I don't know who did the poll or any, and if it's any good or anything like that. But I will tell you.
Garen Hart Yang. They don't really know anything about polling.
Peter D. Hart did that?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Hart's pretty good. So I will tell you this. I think that without something that can be called legitimately repeal and replace, there is no hope. And without job growth, without like we did happen to see last Friday, better than usual. That was good. But without job growth, there is no hope. So you've got, I'm not saying that you've got to have the most world's, to use Trump's phrase, most beautiful healthcare bill. You've got to have something that passes muster as repeal and replace. But the elections next year are going to be on the economy as perceived by average people who actually voted for Trump in hopes of something better.
Is this somewhat of a race by the Senate to repeal and replace because, you know, is it because that, as Trump says, that Obamacare is failing, or is it because, as some others say, that it's getting stronger? I mean, is there a political will to get this done?
Well, first of all, I think that they're going to fail. And I think that they're going to fail, and it's going to be good for them that they failed. And let me tell you what I mean by that. I think the American people, and poll after poll after poll shows us, they just want you to fix Obamacare. They just want to fix the marketplaces. They want to fix Obamacare. They want to fix the glitches that were in the original bill that Democrats have wanted to fix for 8 years and Republican wouldn't cooperate about. So I think that if this fails, McConnell's already said, well, we're going to have to pass a much smaller bill that fixes the marketplace and so on. That's what the American people want. So if they fail, it's actually better for them politically. Because if your base you can tell your base, hey, we tried, and then you wind up actually fixing the bill, and people are happy because Obamacare is over 50%.
David's reply is rooted in fantasy, because the bill is in.
My fantasies are way better than that, buddy.
I don't want to hear about that. The fact is, we are talking. I think Justin, you put it very well. The program is declining into collapse. And its popularity has actually stabilized because why? Because Republicans, my team, are so bad at telling the stories of the people who have been harmed by Obamacare. They are so bad. When was the last time you saw an ad about the total mess of the rollout of Obamacare? When was the last time you saw all of the things that have happened to people who said, the president says I can keep my doctor. Oh, I can't keep. The president says I can keep my plan. Oh, I can't keep my plan. All of that stuff has been forgotten.
But that's not the point. The point is the American people want to know, what are you going to do to make my health care and my health insurance situation better? Well, and because your party is so obsessed with repeal and coming up with these fakakta replacement schemes that the CBO condemns with these numbers of 20 million, 22, 23, 24 million people are going to lose health care.
Those numbers don't mean anything to anybody.
They mean a lot of things to the politicians.
They understand that what happens is when you remove the individual mandate and people say, I'm not going to buy health care, and they leave the marketplace for that reason. The CBO is giving those people to David to use as a talking point, which he does with real admirable regularity. He just repeats those talking points as much as he possibly can.
CBO.
Who understands what CBO's number means also understands that CBO was off by a factor of 100%,
but they
in its original estimate. So the real thing here is folks do want real health care, and they're only going to get it through transparency, not opacity.
And a bipartisan
simplicity.
Bill.
No, well, that's you don't a have any record of a bipartisan bill. I got news for you, pal. You couldn't get
150 Republican amendments. 150 Republican amendments
not
to Obamacare.
One Republican vote
zero
on final passage.
Democratic amendments to this
anyway,
nonsense.
So let's get back to the state of Illinois. We're doing great, but I will tell you this. The Democrats succeeded in making Obamacare a big, honking, rolled-up piece of government black, and it's very hard to unroll it or to unravel it, where you take out one little thing like clinics over here, and then you're hurting inpatient over there. You move this here.
It sounds more to me,
and
a lot of try to be in the middle here, is it sounds like any governmental piece of healthcare work is going to be that. I mean, it's just so much. The stuff that I've seen on the table, especially the Republican bill with the Ted Cruz amendment that he wants to put in about putting sick people in a pool, healthier. I mean, you start to get into this thing of having an understanding of how that might look in 10, 15, 20, 25 years. And it feels the same. We would have the same touche segment about this bill in 10 years.
It's not just what it looks like in 10, 20 years, because the reality is when you talk about the high-risk pools, okay, fine, that's for a cancer survivor. What about just for people who have ordinary pre-existing conditions, which I suspect all of us sitting in this microphones do?
That's a non-event anymore. We've got those people covered.
Yeah, but they're not going to be.
They are
going to
be covered.
They have the right to exempt themselves, Chris. The states have the right to opt out of these things.
They do not have the right to leave people high and dry. They've got a right to experiment. You're afraid of experimentation because that means it takes power away from the bureaucracy that you serve.
I think more right there, if I can be once again right down the middle.
Yeah, Mr. Right Down the Middle.
I think it's more about what the premiums will be for covering pre-existing conditions.
I think that's an old person's tax.
Yeah, you guys are talking about black and white, but I think it's more down the middle gray.
Well, yeah, because if you make $20,000 a year and you have a premium of $12,000, you don't have health insurance.
There you go. Dave
well, that's
Lundy.
The current situation under Obamacare.
Not.
What you have done
no,
is both
is
raised the deductibles and you've raised the cost of participating.
All right, we
gotta
wrap
so nobody
up.
Can participate. That's no health care, David.
As John McLaughlin would say, wrong.
All right. Chris Roebling, Dave
Lundy.
Let's take
our picture.
We're going to take
a picture. I want to be in a picture with you.
We'll
with
see you guys
beard.
Next week.
Yeah, with your big beer.
Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, this morning, Mayor Emanuel, Senator Durbin, and others joined with Amazon to announce that the company is doubling their corporate offices in downtown Chicago. This comes as Amazon makes news for its potential purchase of Whole Foods and continues to push other retail giants for a bigger piece of the retail pie. At the press conference, Amazon announced that they'll be building more fulfillment centers in the state and will employ over 8,000 people by the end of 2018. This is good news for our area. And good news for customers who have bought into the Amazon model and expect their goods delivered within days and in some cases hours. Joining me tonight to talk the future of retail and the future of Amazon in our area is Samantha Singer. She's the general manager for Amazon Chicago office. And a perfect time because Prime Day just began, right? This is really a 30-hour extravaganza that everybody knows about.
That is correct.
Samantha, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So talk about this announcement. I mean, the idea of doubling corporate offices in downtown Chicago, what's the impetus to do so? Was this something that benefits not just Chicago but the company?
I'd say it does both, right? Chicago is a really great fit for Amazon in general, right? The city likes to work hard, play hard, make history. And that's really a lot of what Amazon is about across the board. We always work our way backwards from our customers, and our customers would like us here, so we're scaling and we're growing. We spent the last year doing that, and we'll continue doing that.
You know, I think of Chicago, and Chicago has been such a transit hub for this country, and because of that, retail started here. I mean, there's a lot of things that connect to the Amazon, to the retail of today in 2017. Does Chicago have the same abilities that it had in the past to be a transportation hub, to be a place where Amazon can set up to not just serve Chicago but the Midwest?
Absolutely. I mean, we have other offices in the Midwest that are open. But I'd say that this one's going to grow and scale even more. I know that my team, there's three predominant teams in our corporate office. There's the Amazon Web Services, our media group, and our operations. The Amazon Web Services team, we really work and we service and support the customers all throughout the Midwest.
Being in the Midwest, what does it mean to double the office? I mean, for have one set and then to double that office, I mean, to be the general manager of that office, what are some of the challenges that come with a pretty large, substantial growth?
In general, Chicago has amazing talent, which we love, but I'd say that's always a hard thing is to find the right talent for your teams and to build and scale fast enough to support our customers.
When you talk about that, I mean, where are you looking for talent? I mean, is it people with retail experience? Is it people with corporate experience? When you're doubling a corporate office, where do you look for that talent?
So as I said, there's three predominant teams, right? There's the web services team, so that's Amazon's cloud computing. You've got our media teams, and you've got our operations teams. So on the cloud computing side, I could speak to that more formally. That's where we hire. We'll look at people who have been in technology. We'll look at people out of universities. We've also made a huge pledge to the White House in general across all of Amazon that within the next 5 years, we are going to hire 25,000 veterans and spouses, and we're going to train 10,000 of them in cloud computing. So we're finding them from everywhere, but we've found a lot of Chicagoans wanted to work for Amazon and left and now want to come home. Mm-hmm. And we found a lot of people want to relocate here too. So we always try to find locally and then some people will relocate back into town.
There's a lot that's been made of the corporate culture here in Chicago and the mayor's efforts to bring more business to the Chicago area. Should this be considered that? I mean, is this Amazon investing in the Chicago area, becoming one of the global corporate partners here in the city of Chicago?
I think you should look at it as an investment in our market. Chicago's an amazing city, right? We have a growing tech community. Mayor Emanuel really is a really big advocate for that in general. So I'd say we are definitely making that huge investment. We'd like to make this a very huge tech hub for us.
I asked this question of you, who works, you know, as a general manager in the Chicago office, but do you consider Amazon a tech company?
Well, I work for Amazon Web Services more than any other division, right? Keep in mind that's what I do on a daily basis. Yeah. So I do think of us as a technology company. right? We look for agility, flexibility. We look to invent and think big and on behalf of our customers. So absolutely I do.
It's an interesting tech company because it does, you know, I think about what the tech industry here in Chicago does. I mean, you think of 1871 and what we have going on just downtown along the river in Merchandise Mart. This idea that they're restructuring or rethinking the way that we do business. And Amazon does that and has been doing that, especially when it comes to retail. Do you consider it that way, that you guys are finding a way to use tech and web services to essentially rethink the way that we see retail?
I think the way we look at it is a way for even like our customers, right? We have a lot of small businesses and startups. We have millions of them. And you think about the ones that we actually give the capability to use our marketplace and use our technology to go and actually capture more of a global audience. So I think we're helping a lot of people do that as well, and a lot of customers.
Amazon has been, I mean, you have reinvented and done so much to revitalize the way that retail is shipped, the retail, not just purchased, but shipped. And we've had conversations in here about how a lot of small businesses, shipping has changed for them. I mean, the way that it used to be 4 to 6 weeks, or, you know, we'll get that to you in 6 to 8 weeks or whatever it was. And because of Amazon and the companies that have really invested in the idea of delivery services and things of that nature, they've had to change their model. I mean, do you see the retail world getting faster? Do you see that we're going to go from what it used to be 6 to 8 weeks to 2 to 3 weeks to a 24-hour period to hours to minutes? I mean, is that what Amazon's end game is here? To essentially for me to think it and get it?
I don't have a crystal ball, so I can't answer that. I can tell you, right, I believe that Amazon has changed things, right? Amazon Prime, 1 in 2 hour. It's really big in the city. Like, you think about that in general, right? Think where we are. Think River North. Think the Loop, Noble Square, Near West. These are the prime areas of Chicago that are using 1 in 2 hour delivery. I think about it in an urban area, and I think that's just something that you're seeing. But I can't answer for really where the future will go.
Samantha Singer's in studio with us tonight. She is the general manager of Amazon Chicago office. Of course, today a big press conference where Amazon said they're going to be not only doubling their corporate offices but building more fulfillment centers in the state. I always think about Amazon Prime Day because this is something that you guys have been doing for a couple of years now. As almost becomes every day, in the sense that everyone feels like more and more the model which you set out to have, which was subscribe for this delivery service, Amazon Prime, and you can get faster delivery and service and all that, has become the norm, where anyone who uses Amazon just signs up for Amazon Prime. How do you see that working out in the sense that there has been a saturation, meaning everybody wants Amazon Prime, everybody gets it, so there's not a lot of room for growth in terms of the idea that, you know, you're going to max out at 100%.
As a Prime user, right? So let's just look at it from my perspective. I don't get a say in what happens with Prime. I don't know the deals that we're going to have tomorrow. I'm going to find them out when you do. But I'd say I think Prime has changed personally over the years and even how my family uses it, right? We use Prime. I use Alexa to reorder. I use Prime Video. I use Prime Photos to upload my photos and to store things in the cloud. So to me, there's just different services and the way they interrelate things. I don't know really how much more they'll change it. I don't really get to say. I'd love to. I'd love to be the person who thinks really big and invents and simplifies there, but I take advantage of all the benefits that you do at the same time.
Let's talk as a customer. I mean, just in a very small amount of time, we have seen Amazon go from really a clearinghouse to get certain goods in a certain time frame to the ability to get something in an hour or 2 hours. I mean, and dominate in doing that, meaning they're the central hub. Talk about being a part of that company, but also as a customer, about how fast retail is changing. It feels to me that we're kind of in a moment right now where retail is going from what we used to know in different decades to something brand new right now.
So to me, Amazon is just one of these amazing places to work, right? It's a really fun place to work. It's really collaborative. We get to work with really high-performing teams. It's really flexible. We have really good benefits as an organization. As a customer of Amazon and Amazon Prime, it has changed the way that I personally do things, right? I don't really go shopping that often anymore. I have an Amazon box that arrives at my, you know, house on a pretty daily basis with almost anything and everything I want. When I think about anything I need, the first thing I do is I open my Amazon app and I order. Probably just like... Yeah. Most of my girlfriends do the exact same thing. We all joke about it.
Yeah, right. I mean, I do the same thing. But I wonder about, as we are in this touch point moment, mm-hmm. where more and more people, I mean, are choosing to do retail this way. if – do you see it from not just your vantage point at Amazon but also as a customer that there aren't as many choices? It's not go down the main street in your town and see six different retails and make a choice. I mean, that we are seeing a difference in the way that, that we as Americans choose to buy our products and more importantly, get our products.
Well, I would say there's definitely a difference in the way that we want to buy and get our products. I think – for as much as you're talking about kind of a scale down of not being able to go down the street, I think I have more options online now. I think about all of these millions of small businesses that now I have access to that I never would have had access to. I now have access and they have access to all of our marketplace. So I think about all the different things that I can now get that were maybe never sitting here in Chicago down the street in a store for me. So I think it works both ways.
Yeah. I'm interested, as you double your size here in Chicago, what goes into that? Do you have to double your space? Do you have to think about your relationship with the buildings that you're in, the area, the neighborhoods, the communities? It's not just about doubling the size of personnel that are in the room. It's about a bigger footprint. So what does that mean for Amazon to have a bigger corporate footprint in Chicago?
So we did actually have to – we just signed a lease to double our size. We truly had to double the size of the footprint of the office. You most certainly don't want people on top of each other in a space. Right now, we have about 58 jobs open, but the office will support 400 people. Currently, right now, it's 200. The expansion will support 400 people down the line. And, you know, if we keep expanding, we'll have to keep finding more space. I mean, it's what you've seen Amazon do in Seattle, where we consistently grow. It's definitely a lot of thought has to be put into it and how the teams are growing. Can we find the right talent in our market? And can we support our customers this way?
When you talk about being a corporate citizen of Chicago, it's more than just the space and it's more than just the name that's on the masthead, that the building that you go into. What does Amazon have to do to be a good corporate citizen besides just doubling the office and providing jobs for people that live in this area?
We're fortunate that we have really good Amazonians in our office. One of my colleagues today came up and talked about an in-office culture club, which is something that we started. So being a good corporate citizen and a good Chicago citizen is being part of the community. And so what we do is dozens of Amazonians get together every month and we pick a non-for-profit. And we like to go in and we like to get involved in the community and volunteer. Today at the event, we announced actually our partnership and our assistance with Code Platoon. I don't know if you're familiar with them. We made a $10,000 donation to them. It's a non-profit to help veterans learn how to code. It's a 20-week in-depth program, 6 weeks remote, 14 weeks in-depth on-site, and it allows them, for people who have no experience in anything in technology, to come out and be able to do web development and really help them. So we're going to offer our facilities, we're going to help train them, and we most certainly offer them some funding.
You've mentioned before about being a tech company and also the idea of web development and is that part of the corporate side. You know, and take us through this because, you know, I'd be the first person to say I'm not familiar too much of web technology or web services. But what do you have to do to make sure that Amazon delivers what they promise? And what I mean is they come to the site and it's Prime Day right now, starting now, and they go there and Amazon is a site that can't have outages. It can't have, you know, certain spots where, oh, this is taking forever to load or there's a problem with the carry out. How do you make sure that that stuff doesn't happen in a world in which I feel like that automatically we feel like is harder and harder to do?
There are dozens of teams that actually help us do this. One of the nicest things about Amazon Web Services, and we talk about this with our customers, is our flexibility and agility and the fact that you can elastically grow. We do that for ourselves. We do that for our customers. So it's something that we're prepared for, and there are many teams behind all of us that are working on this.
As Amazon grows and technology grows and you have more cloud, more mobile, more different ways we hadn't even thought about that we're going to be communicating and doing business and commerce on platforms, I mean, do you have to stay ahead of the curve? Do you have to start thinking of not just as a retail company but as a technology company that thinks about how we're all going to use devices in the future?
So when you think about, you know, when I think about Amazon, right, you know, I think one of the biggest benefits is loving what we do, but it allows us to come in and think big and invent on behalf of our customers. So the sky's the limit. There's so many, like, limitless possibilities of what we can do that makes it a really exciting place to work and to be able to come up with these kind of ideas.
Do you have to – you find yourself having to compete for the best tech talent who may be thinking about platforms or e-commerce or other places that, you know, people don't think of Amazon that way, but you have to go out and find the best people to work in your office because there's a lot on the line?
There's a lot of talent, though, in Chicago. There's a lot of amazing talent. I'll just not say here, right across the globe there is. But there is amazing talent, and you always want to find the next talent, right? We always want to talk about how do we take students in universities and really make them our next talent and make an investment in them. How do we take veterans and train them to make them our next talent? So we're always looking for good talent. I don't think there's an endless stream of it, but I think it's pretty amazing out there.
All right. Well, right now, Prime Day has begun. Samantha Singer is the general manager for Amazon Chicago office. They just announced today, press conference with Mayor Emanuel and Senator Durbin and others, that they are doubling their corporate offices in downtown Chicago, bringing more fulfillment centers to the state, and they're going to employ around 8,000 people by the end of 2018. Samantha, thanks so much for taking some time. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Tomorrow night on the show, Professor Al Genie returns. That's right. Our resident philosopher going to talk. We're going to finish, I think it was in the spring, we did the seven deadly sins. Remember that one? Did seven deadly sins. We talked about what the seven deadly sins are and where they come from. And there's a companion piece called the seven virtues, of course, what makes you a good person. So we'll talk about the virtues tomorrow night here in the download. Also coming up a little bit later in the show, Glenn Mercer from the Feelies is going to join us. The Feelies kind of getting back together. They're on stage at Pitchfork this week in the Pitchfork Music Festival. Coming to Chicago. Headliners Solange, Tribe Called Quest, LCD Sound System. The Feelies, a great band from, I would say 80s. They started in the 70s, but 80s sort of modern rock, college rock band from New Jersey. Getting back together for Pitchfork. There's going to be a big show coming up for them. So the Feelies, Glenn Mercer, going to join us in the 9 o'clock hour. Also, Mike Sula is going to be here from the Chicago Reader. Talk about his restaurant recommendations. I'm excited to have him. We've never had Mike in studio. Mike is a True Blue restaurant reviewer. You know, when you have True Blue restaurant reviewers, they're the ones that give fake names when they go to restaurants because they don't want to get favorable treatment, right? So he wears, when he does interviews like this, he wears masks.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm interested to see what kind of mask. Yeah. Is it like one of those old-timey plastic masks with a rubber band in the back?
He's got a few, he said. I don't know. Like is he going to be like
a wrestler?
Is he going to be like Point Break where he's got like a Clinton mask or something
like
that? Yeah. So that's coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. And coming up here right after the news, Kim Gordon's going to join us, preview the big three-part series she's got coming up about Chicago violence, which starts tomorrow. Great to talk to her about what she's discovered. It's interesting. I mean, it's not just about preventing violence. It's about confronting violence. You know, you've been hearing the promos all day, but it really is about what are people doing to deal with some of the side effects or cause and effect. I mean, yes, there's going to be policing tactics and, you know, ways to get guns off the street and try to use conflict resolution to deal with gangbangers, things like that. But what about the people that are involved around in the community? PTSD plays a part. We'll talk with Kim Gordon about her series, which starts tomorrow here on WGN. And then 10 o'clock tonight, So Pretty. What would you call these guys? I mean, I feel like they're a punk band because there's like melodies and screaming at the same time.
Yeah, I would say that. Yeah. Rock punk.
Yeah. But I mean, it's really great music. And they'll start off with like sort of like a really lull you in with a nice melody, and then it's just screaming. 10 seconds. I like it. I like it a lot.
It's a wake up. Yeah.
It's a good 10 o'clock.
This is really nice.
It's a good Studio 435. Here we are. I'll save it. Bob Ferguson's got his work cut out for him tonight.
Kind of like having kids.
there's a nice
melody and then screaming.
Or a cat. Here's what I get with a cat.
Don't get me started.
Oh, my wife just gave me an update, which is not a good one. So she took it upon herself to take the kitten out of the room. Right, here we go. And let the cat explore under her supervision.
Uh-huh.
He went into the front room, started to meow, started to like kind of like scratch at the corners of the carpet, and then pooped. Yeah, so I don't know what that means.
Now, was Mrs. Justin on board with the cat purchase?
Oh my gosh,
the cat thing?
No, I'm the reluctant one in the relationship.
Okay.
For all three. I was sort of like, really? Do I want to go this route? But that I don't know. She looked it up. There's no, you know, I'm sure it's something behavioral. It's probably more about where's the litter box, can't find the litter box kind of thing. But good start. Strong start.
We've had our cat for, you know, a long time, and just wait till, like, last night, for instance, you know, every 10 minutes, like, swatting the remote off the table in the middle of the night, every book that you have on it, whoosh. And then you look at him, and he just looks at you like, yeah, I'm doing this 3 in the morning.
Well, Pete, you had me rolling when, about a month ago, you just quite simply said your cat's a dick.
A lovable one, but yes.
And that just cracked me up, because that just about sums up a cat.
Well, we were going to try to do this thing where we were going to put the room be my son's room, and then he would sleep in the room. And the minute the light went off, the cat got a little feisty. He just jumped up and down and jumped off the bed. And my son was like, I can't sleep. Oh, and I'm like, whoa, this is nothing compared to what's going to happen. I don't think you're ready on your first night. You couldn't deal with maybe 15 seconds of a cat, a kitten pouncing. Yikes. So we'll see. Thank you, Rob. Download here on 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Coming up, Mike Sula is going to join us, talk about his restaurant recommendations, restaurant reviewer for the Chicago Reader. Great writer, award-winning writer. It's actually a James Beard. I think he's an award winner or a nominee, but he should have won for his piece, his great piece he did on squirrels. He had done a tremendous piece about researching if he could catch and eat squirrels in the city of Chicago. And the answer is no. But this huge piece in the Reader, it was a main piece about that there are other places in this country, you know, great
places.
You
didn't know Granny Clampett.
Exactly. That's not a law. So why is it a law here? And he went through it. So Mike Sula will be on. We'll talk about restaurant recommendations, good buddy. And also coming up 9:30, Glenn Mercer from the Feelies is going to join us. Feelies, New Jersey band that's going to be at Pitchfork coming up this weekend. Well, all this week, WGN News reporter Kim Gordon's producing a series called Turning the Tide on Violence. It's a 3-part audio series that looks at Chicago violence, what's being done in communities to prevent it, but also to confront it. So that's a part that seems to always get sort of pushed to the wayside. Kim Gordon in studio. Kim, good to see you. Thanks for being here. I know
my pleasure. I'm excited to be here.
You already worked a long shift, so I appreciate you coming
in
and talking about it.
Dinner with my son, and now I'm here. So it was nice. Nice right. Break.
So let's start. So this starts tomorrow, but this is a story. Where does this idea come from? The idea of exploring violence in this way.
Well, this actually started back in 2014. Pastor Chris Harris, who's the pastor, senior pastor at Bronzeville Church at Bright Star Church in Bronzeville. Went on a trip to Israel in 2014, and he visited a place in Tel Aviv. It's a nonprofit organization called Natal. And when he was there seeing what Natal does, and I'll explain in a moment, he kind of had his aha moment for what this could do for his neighborhood in Chicago. And what Natal does is for the past 20 years in Israel, they serve people who have suffered from PTSD from violence, terrorism, and
right.
and war. And so what happens, there's a hotline to call, say you're in a neighborhood, you are part of a terror attack or, you know, a bus bomb or even a soldier in the army who suffered some kind of PTSD moment. You will call this hotline and the Natal, someone will answer the phone there, be it a psychologist, a social worker, a psychiatrist, and you tell them, I need help, and they will get you to the right people. And they've served in Israel over hundreds of thousands. Doesn't matter gender.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter whether you're an Arab Israeli, a Jewish Israeli. As long as you're an Israeli, they will serve you.
And it makes sense. I mean, obviously, you think about sort of the unrest and the violence and the terrorism that's happened in Israel over decades now. It makes sense that there's
Absolutely.
A lot of situations that are really mentally unsettling. And very... Not very often do they apply that to Chicago violence. And we've heard more and more psychologists and doctors talk about the idea that there is a ripple effect to what's happening here in Chicago and in neighborhoods when people witness or involved with or around it at such a constant the way it is right now.
You know, and Pastor Harris saw what this program, the success rate that this program has had, and he knew that he had to tweak it to come to Chicago. And so the really, I would say there's several tweaks and several things that he wants to change, and we can get into that. But the major tweak that he saw was that he knew that if he was going to help the African-American community, he knew it couldn't be through psychologists, social workers. There is a stigma among the African-American community about that. And he knew that he had to find people that they could trust. So he decided that he was going to train pastors all across the community. And so he started out by training 60 pastors. The Natal people have been here, you know, in and out for the past 3 years, but they came for an intensive 5-week training. They're starting out with 60 pastors. They hope to expand it, and not just African-American pastors. They, you know, eventually want to expand it to rabbis and priests and anybody who wants to be part of this. And there's now live a hotline number to call at Bronzeville Church. And the program is called TURN, because they knew Natal people couldn't understand what that meant in Bronzeville. So they named it the TURN Center, and TURN stands for the Urban Resilience Network.
So would the idea be similar in the way that there would be a phone number to call?
Yes.
And it would be pastors that'd be on the other end, as opposed to psychologists and therapists?
Exactly. And they will get you the help that you need. And they're actually, they not only want the victims to call, but they want the suspects' families to call, because that's how they feel like they are going to end this violence, by getting people the help they need to treat the immediate situation, and then to find the underlying situations that are causing the violence. So in other words, they will all get them to therapists or things that they need to get over the initial shock of what's happened. And then if it's somebody without a job, or somebody without a home, or a kid who needs mentoring, or a kid who needs a job, they're going to find, they're going to help find that for them. And they're going to walk these people through. They're not just going to dump them. You know, they could be with them for a year or more. And the great thing is about this program is that they're also bringing in the United Way, Northwestern University, and University of Chicago. Not only are they helping to fund the program, but they're also helping with all the other things that are necessary. And at the same time, they're documenting, keeping numbers, keeping, you know, they're going to kind of keep watch on how this program is doing and where it needs to go and how it needs to be adjusted.
I mean, that is really at the core when you talk about, you know, taking on Chicago violence, is not just, you know, obviously the police strategy to take away guns from gangbangers and be able to keep the body count down. We talk about shootings and killings, but there's also this impact on the community. And we've seen through, you know, just the way that the state of Illinois has had their budget fight, that social service agencies haven't, when people say social service agencies aren't getting paid, this is the kind of social service agency that would fall into that category. How important is it to have the United Way and the University of Chicago involved in making sure that the pastors, that Pastor Harris, can actually do what needs to be done? Because as you said, you can't shortchange a problem. You can't say, I'll take this one call and I'll never respond again.
Right. Oh, I think it's crucial. First of all, United Way, they're putting in over $500,000 in this program to start. And they've done most of the, I would say all of the fundraising has pretty much come from private donors. And they're actually going to be having a big fundraiser next month to keep the money flowing in, because they don't know, you know, it's brand new. So they have no idea how much is this, what the cost is going to be, but they have a great start. And so it's just to have all these different professionals who have been in this field for so long all come together under one umbrella, I think is really going to help change things.
Kim Gordon's in studio, WGN News reporter, of course. Her series, Turning the Tide on Violence, a 3-part series, starts tomorrow here on WGN, looking at not just the preventative issues, but also how to confront violence, especially the impact to some of the people that are around violent situations. You talked about the training and what actually goes into this. I mean, can you talk a little bit about what it is? Like specifically, what is Natal doing when somebody calls up? I mean, what are the things that they ask, or how that kind of works out?
I don't exactly know. You know, we didn't quite get into exactly how it works. But I know it was 5 weeks of very intensive training, and everybody who was part of the training told me that nobody will ever be the same going through what they've been through. I know one of the things that they did focus on was having the pastors kind of deal with their own personal issues, because so many of these pastors, so many of the people in these neighborhoods have been touched by violence in some way.
Right.
And for a lot of us, it's like everybody knows somebody who's had cancer. Unfortunately, in these neighborhoods, somebody knows somebody who's suffered violence, whether it's your own family member, somebody in your church, a next door neighbor. So they had them deal with their own personal feelings first before they could even train them so that they would be able to confront their own demons, I guess, in a way.
And I would assume have some or extra empathy in,
right.
in situations where they would be able to know exactly what the person is going through.
You know, and even though this is based in Bronzeville, this is absolutely... They want to make this citywide. So, and there's even hopes from the Natal standpoint and the Bright Star standpoint is that this could be expanded into other cities nationwide. Because like I said, it's been so successful in Israel. They kind of want to share what they've learned over these decades of violence.
Is there any way that you see this being something that, you know, could come from the city government, from the state government? That Natal, of course, is it's not for profits, and the idea that the United Way and the University of Chicago are involved. But is it something that you could see being part of a funded city program to deal with some of the issues in this town?
Oh, I think it's certainly possible. Maybe, you know, in some ways they want to keep it separate just because they want to feel like they're kind of, you know, they don't want to hitch their wagon to anything. I don't think they want to become political.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're doing this for all the right reasons, and it may be best to keep it separate. But down the road, who knows?
Well, it's a great series. Check it out. It's airing late. I mean, it airs all day tomorrow.
I believe it's 7:30, 10:30, 1:30, 5:30. So,
and it'll
also be on WGN Radio.
And this is Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday.
Yes.
All right. Kim Gordon, the series is called Turning the Tide on Violence. It's a three-part series that'll air here on WGN Radio. And as she just said, you can WGNRadio.com. Kim, it's a great series. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I'm looking forward to hearing it.
Thank you.
Pete, I haven't been paying attention. Who's winning the home run derby? I hate the home run derby.
Justin, of course, the winners are the young kids that are out there retrieving the balls that don't quite make it over.
Am I the only one who's like, some kid's going to miss that ball and get smashed right in the head in the nose? Am I the only one who thinks that way?
No.
Yeah.
I think we all kind of hope for them to drop balls deep down.
That's why we watch. See the teenager with his cool glove, his rich outfit. Out there about to make a catch, misjudges the ball under the lights. Whack! Right in the nose. Right in the kisser. Yeah. You know, this weekend we had a great show for Amy Cross Rosenthal.
That's right.
We talked about it on Friday. Amy Cross Rosenthal, of course, great Chicago writer and filmmaker and all-around artist who passed away from cancer back in March. We had a big sort of fundraiser kickoff to her gallery show at Seacrest Gallery in the West Loop on Saturday night. It was great. Great people. Turnout was huge. Standing room for people to watch some great performances from Tony Rogers and Susan McLaughlin Carp, as well as Mark Baser and John Green, Claire Zulke. It was fun. But it was funny because there was this great moment where Susan McLaughlin Carp, she read a different piece than she did on the show. And she talked all about, it was a piece that she had worked with Amy, and she had talked about, she had a reference to Transitions Bookstore. And if you remember Transitions, it was a personal growth, spiritual, new age bookstore where the Epic Burger is now on North and Sheffield, right? Next to the Whole Foods. Or is that Whole Foods even there anymore? No, it's not there anymore. Now it's like a Pete's Coffee or something. Anyway. And I realized, I'm like, wow, what an amazing moment. I worked at Transitions. Like, I worked in the coffee shop for, like, maybe a year. I got great stories. I need to write a book about working in the New Age coffee shop.
Oh, yeah. What,
right?
Yeah. I'm sure that it was a
college.
Treat.
I was at Columbia College. I met a lot of people at that store and have some fun stories. I realized I need to do my one-man show about working at Transitions. You know, it'd be just like when Fred Armisen does a one-man show on Saturday Night Live.
I'd buy a ticket to that.
Yeah. It was, I mean, that was a bookstore. I'll just give it that. I did not work at the original. The original was on Armitage, and then they expanded to that complex on North Avenue. And they added a coffee shop, and I was working at Starbucks, and I got hired out to go over there and
made the transition from the Bucks to Transitions, huh?
Transitions. The only thing I could say is that when we would close, we would just rock as loud as we could the new age music. Like, we just turn that dial. Wow. And that was the music that we'd listen to while we were sweeping up the coffee shop and putting the dishes away. Like that. That was essentially my life. But Susan had a reference to it, and I was like, "Oh, I completely forgot about that."
Now, I know you put the show together. Did you perform? Were you?
I did. I didn't really perform.
Just kind of like
I was like the MC.
So
yeah.
Do a couple.
I did.
I did things.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I was doing bits until like everybody ran long, and I was like, "Well, no more bits. Here's the next person." Yeah, it was fun. It was great. And that's a great gallery space right there in the West Loop. It's right next to Maria Pinto's place. And on the other side, John Mannion's place, Elche Bar. So it's right on Washington and Green Street. And I'm like, man, I never had Carrie Sechrist on. I'd love to talk with her. She used to have a gallery in the River North area. Like, you know where Superior kind of goes to diagonal parking spots over there by Wells?
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Where it's like, why is this the one street where everything's diagonal and everywhere else is parallel? And there was that's a gallery area, arts gallery area, famed here in Chicago for years. And she used to be a part of that. That's where she got her name. And she moved over to the West Loop early in the West Loops, like 2002, 2003. But she'd be a great person to have on for the big table. I'm learning all about her gallery when I was there. So I'm going to reach out and see if she'll come on. But yeah, that's the stretch right there. I mean, that is it.
That's where that's happening area of the city.
So it was really great to drive by. Like, I drove by before the show, and I got to see they've got in the window, like, a yellow, you know, sort of font. It's like Amy, it says AKR, a beauty salon, running through August 10th. And to see Amy, who, you know, is a great friend, and to see her work on display and to continue to be on display, you know, to still have an impact in Chicago, even though she's passed. It's just great, and it's so Amy. That's what's so great about it, like to be in a position where you get a chance to have that kind of impact after you're gone. Her family and this great, her daughter read something in Paris. It was great. So, yeah, good stuff. It was a good show. It was good to see all those people, too. All right, coming up, Mike Sula is going to join us, as well as Glenn Mercer from the Feelies. That's coming up here on The Download. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Time for Industry Nights, our weekly segment where we talk about the food and hospitality industry here in Chicago. And today in studio, one of the vets of the industry, you wouldn't know by his face because you're not supposed to see it, Chicago Reader, restaurant reviewer, Mike Sula is in studio. It's going to be hard to talk to you, man, as you're wearing a mask. Because you are the
just
old...
Just pretend I'm naked.
You are the old school reviewer. Good to see you, first off.
Yeah,
always great to have you here, man. Even though I haven't had you on this show, which is crazy to think about. All right. First question out the box. Mike has written for The Reader for years. One of the best food writers, not just in the city, but in the country. James Beard Award winner. The only food person on Industry Night we've ever had who's wearing a Mexican wrestling mask. Why the mask? Why do you have to still wear the mask?
Well, you know, I don't like to make it easy for servers and chefs and restaurant managers to recognize me. I don't want them to see me coming, so I have to wear a mask when I go out. I have quite a few of them. I like to mix it up. I don't want to wear the same mask every time because then they know it was me, right? So here I am.
When you go to a restaurant, are you still, I mean, it's such an lost art form, the idea of giving a different name or having a different name on a credit card or what it is. I mean, you still go with all those sort of OG kind of ways of reviewing restaurants?
Like I said, I don't like to make it easy. I know my picture is up on the wall in some kitchens around town, maybe a lot. I don't know. I've seen it. I have friends that have taken pictures of me hanging on the wall. But, you know, I've been doing it for a long time, and it's inevitable that, you know, the longer you do it, the more you're going to get recognized. But, you know, there's kind of an unspoken contract, too, that, you know, most if they know you're there, they don't make a big deal out of it.
Right.
So.
Well, that's, I mean, that's what you're trying to avoid, is the fact that they know you're there, so they put on something that might be fake or try to overserve or give you things
right.
and try to sort of convince you to give a good review by giving you stuff they don't give a regular person.
Sure, sure. And I mean, it's funny, though, because there have been times where I've been pretty sure I've been recognized and I've had just completely atrocious, disastrous service. So I mean, it often doesn't work, and, you know, it doesn't work that way. But, you know, it doesn't, if it happens often, people usually don't let on.
Yeah.
So there's an unspoken bond.
Couldn't that be fixed by just the restaurant industry and the reviewers getting together and being like, okay, we have to do this. You have to do this. Like, don't like this. Let's just don't be a jerk, you know, or don't try to do things to, you know, is it or just greed gets in the way?
Well, I think in most cases that is the understanding with this sort of like traditional, you know, anonymous form of, you know, restaurant criticism. I mean, the lines between the food writing world and the actual industry are so blurred right now. I mean, there's huge segments of the, you know, food media that have no qualms about, you know, taking comps in exchange for publicity. So I don't know. I don't want to say this is like, you know, it's a dying breed, but it is increasingly outnumbered by the other kinds.
I feel like, and as somebody who falls more into the category of general interest, where I'll have chefs on and I will have different restaurant experiences, I've just noticed this over 20 years of doing it, that restaurants today are less likely to comp you out or give you special stuff than, say, 10, 15 years ago. Like, maybe because there's so many writers, there's so many people doing this kind of work or interviewing, that it just seems like that's not even on the table anymore.
It might be. I mean, you know, I'm sure everybody's different. You know, restaurant margins are, you know, notoriously slim, and restaurants, you know, some restaurants probably have more of an ability to, you know, grease the wheels than others do. I think it's probably different on all levels of the industry.
Yeah, it's interesting. Mike Sula in studio. He's a restaurant reviewer for the Chicago Reader, as well as a James Beard Award winner, in studio tonight to talk about his work. You know, as a reviewer, I mean, you have made your name on feature work. I mean, you do a lot of stuff for magazines. You do a ton of work for beyond just reviewing restaurants for the Reader. I mean, the piece you won for was about Cooking Squirrel, which was an awesome piece. But where do you find your happiness? I mean, are you more the kind of writer who likes to dip into the feature work where you're talking about a specific thing like Cooking Squirrels, or are you still, or do you feel like, you know, your bread is buttered when you're reviewing a restaurant anonymously?
Yeah, I love nothing more than like getting deep into the guts of a feature. I mean, that's what I started doing for the Reader. Like, what is it? It's 20 years now, 22 years now.
Wow.
That's what I did. I was a feature writer at large with no deadlines and no space limit. And, you know, it was the golden age. And, you know, I sort of started to find this niche and you know, they needed a restaurant reviewer. And that's what I find myself doing more and more. You know, I had to hit a deadline every week. But, you know, I came up writing features, and that's what I love to do.
You know, for you as a writer and someone who has to go across and do a fancy restaurant downtown and then do something else that might be ethnic cuisine on the Northwest Side or maybe hit out a suburban restaurant, is there a specific kind of food or cuisine where you're like, this is my jam, this is where I'm at, I want to be here, if I get to choose what I'm reviewing this week, it's always going to be this kind of food?
Yeah, I mean, I think my comfort food is Korean food. I was lucky enough to spend... When I was much younger, I spent about 5 weeks in Korea. My mother-in-law is Korean. She's a great cook. And I, like, if I have something, you know, if a Korean restaurant coming up on the books, I'm really excited for it. I'm invariably disappointed in it because I've had, you know, I've eaten Korean home cooking in Korea. My mother-in-law is fantastic. So I'm pretty spoiled in that regard, but I still love it. I have a review of a new Korean restaurant in Chinatown coming out next week.
What is it about the food? What is it about those flavors that attracts you?
I don't know. I think it's just, I mean, it is like, it's super hearty. It's homey. It's comfortable. At the same time, it can be incredibly aggressive and funky and spicy. And it's just, it's, you know, it's hugely varied too. I mean, you don't finish a meal without soup and rice, but you could end up starting that meal with, you know, piles of like barbecue or something like that. It's just, you know, it's just, it's all, it always just seems like a feast. You know, I'll go home for Thanksgiving and my mother-in-law will just lay down just this incredible spread at the center of which is just maybe like some goat stew, but there's all this attendant stuff around it. So I don't know. It's just, I think it's just like the most inviting, welcoming kind of everyday feast situation.
Mike Sula is in studio tonight. He's the restaurant reviewer for the Chicago Reader, feature writer as well. Done a lot of stuff, including winning a James Beard for Cooking Up Squirrel, writing about Cooking Up Squirrel, and then doing it. But anyway, find that piece. It's good. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back. More Mike Sula here at Industry Night. Stay with us. So you can do all radio segments where the guest wears a mask. Mike Sula's in studio, the longtime restaurant writer and reviewer, food writer for the Chicago Reader, also a freelancer, also an award winner, but still old school in the way that he doesn't want people to see his face when he's out in public doing interviews, because then the restaurants will be like, there he is! We got him! So he has donned a Mexican wrestling mask tonight. You can check it out, WGNradio.com, the live stream, if you want to see Mike's choice in Mexican wrestling masks. All right, so let's talk about, I mean, let me start with, you work for the Reader, and you've done it for 20-plus years, but you also freelance other places.
Sure.
You are contributing to Dill Magazine, which is new.
Yep.
And so first tell me about that, but then I also want to ask about just the landscape for food writing in general. But first, let's talk about Dill. Where's Dill come from?
Dill is Dill's brand new. Their debut issue drops on Saturday. Dill is just, there's like a pretty amazing story behind it. Dill is this magazine that's just focuses on the foodways of Asia, the home cooking of Asia. And it was started by a young woman named Shane Chemevanitjagoon, who is a sophomore at University of Illinois at Urbana. And she has marshaled an army of seasoned food journalists to help her put this issue out. It's a beautifully lavishly photographed quarterly, and their inaugural issue is on noodles. And there's an international cast of you know, well-known food writers that are in it. Lila Bunyaratabun is in it. She's a half-time Chicago resident who's probably like the foremost expert writing in English on Thai food. Robin Eckhart is in it, who's just a super, you know, well-known and talented food writer based in Penang. I've got a piece in it. I'm writing about the hand-pulled noodles at Jibek Jolu in a Kyrgyz restaurant in Lincoln Square, Lincoln Bend. You ever had those? Lagman. They're the best. They're so good.
Just, where is
like,
it?
Fresh hand-pulled noodles. Like up on Lincoln Bend, they make these. They take a lump of dough and they stretch it and fold it over and stretch it and fold it over until it's this web of tensile, you know, worms, and they, you know, spin their arms like windmills and slap them on the table, and they're just like these magical noodles, and they're just doused with this, you know, super delicious beef stew. It's fantastic. So yeah, that's it. It comes out this Saturday. They're doing there's a Thai food festival, Taste of Thai Town, on Pulaski. They're gonna have a booth there. They're gonna be selling the issue 20% off. Also, Green City Market on the 29th. It's pretty cool.
Right, they're gonna.
They already have like issues in the book. They're actually sending me in October to Thailand for 8 months on an assignment. Secret,
what?
A secret mission.
8 months?
No. I'm sorry. No, I might
eight
stay.
Days?
I might just stay for 8 months. 8 days. I'll be gone for eight days.
These magazine budgets—they've really gone up.
Yeah, man. Yeah. The money's gone somewhere, right?
Well, I mean, speaking of the money, I mean, I've always wondered, because a couple of years back there seemed to be more and more food sites that would come out, food magazines, food online opportunities for writers. And at a certain point, they kind of went by the wayside. If we see in 2017, Chicago is less populated in that space.
Mm.
You know, I think about it because I guess the question that I want to ask is how many of those sites were paying food writers to write about it, or how much do they sort of play on the idea that this is a passion, that people love food, and you should you love to eat at restaurants? Me too. Yeah. I'm going to write about it. I mean, that's sometimes who you have to compete against mm-hmm. as a professional, the idea that there is so much more in the amateur space than there ever was before.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, a lot of those sites that shut down, you know, recognize that it's not very profitable, and maybe the space was too crowded. You know, I don't know what some of the, like, the local food gossip sites pay like, but, you know, I know the Eater National site, they pay pretty well. I wrote a feature for them, and it was great. But, I mean, you're definitely right that there's been a sort of a shrinkage in that online food media, but that's also, I mean, that's certainly paralleled the print media as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's, you know, old school restaurant critics are dwindling in numbers. I mean, we've certainly seen that decrease here in Chicago. You know, I'm essentially the food critic for the Sun Times. Also, they run my column in the Friday agenda section. So, I don't know. I guess the only thing I can think of is just that it's money. You know, there's not enough.
But it's such a. As the print world shrinks, and you Sun Times and Reader are involved with that right now, and less and less is more and more. The contrast in this case is that the food writing world has exploded, meaning that mm-hmm. the restaurants are on every corner, that there seems to be more interest in food blogs and mm-hmm. food sites. So, I mean, it is interesting to see how major media companies deal with covering the food landscape. I mean, the Tribune has doubled down. They have two or three people.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually really impressive. I mean, I think that's a rare example of a publication bulking up its food coverage.
I mean, is that something that you think might be a trend where you see more and more bulking up of the coverage, whether it be in the New York Times or whether it be at Eater or what have you, because there's just more interest by the eating public to read about the restaurants they want to go to?
There's more interest, but there's a consequent explosion of people just doing it on their own, people that just have passion for it and that don't really care about being paid or don't care about being published in an established mainstream publication. So, I mean, you can, Instagram is actually a great example of this. I mean, there are people that are just incredibly talented photographers and even writers that are doing, incredible research that are just incredible research and work that are just doing it because they love it.
Yeah, it feels like, it does feel to me that I think about Instagram as a good example of I can go to a restaurant now. And I can look at the menu and say, oh, I wonder what this looks like, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And I go to the Instagram feed, the hashtag that people have already set up for this restaurant, and all of the dishes are there because somebody else crowdsourced for me and did it. Yeah. No one's getting paid for that.
As I was saying that, I was thinking I'm completely ignoring the Instagram influencers who are getting paid.
Oh, they are,
And it is sort of a pay-for-play situation where people are actually getting paid to promote brands. Oh, yeah, that's completely rampant. I mean, that's a big thing.
So when I'm looking at some of those pictures, those were paid people that are Instagramming the restaurant stuff?
A lot often.
Oh, God.
I wouldn't.
Mike, you're killing me here.
I'm sorry.
I thought this was the democracy in action.
No, you can usually tell when an Instagrammer continually posts like the same place over and over again. I mean, there's something going on there. Sorry,
nothing
now.
Is real. Mike Sula in studio. He is the restaurant reviewer and writer for the Reader and the Sun Times.
Yeah.
You said that.
Yeah.
Mike, of course, an award-winning James Beard Award winner, as well as a freelancer who works in other places, including Dill Magazine, which is just coming out this Saturday. You know, as I think about your perch at the Reader, I mean, 20 plus years, you must have seen so many different trends. You know, from the small plates explosion to no reservations to people arguing about what's online, what's not. I mean, do you notice that as a reviewer? Do you notice from sort of being in it when a whole industry or a whole scene kind of shifts and we go from one kind of restaurant to another?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's funny because when it happens like that, it's almost that you don't notice it gradually, but suddenly you look around you and you notice that. Wow, you know, a dozen pizza places opened this year. A dozen like high-end artisanal pizza places opened this year. They're everywhere. I don't want to go to another one. It happens all the time. And right now, the thing is, you know, it's amazing how, just a few, I would say, you know, maybe 6 years ago, Chicago was known as like this the pork, you know, but the
oh yeah, right, right,
you know, pork belly of the nation, and it was just everywhere, awful meat, and right now that's like swung completely full circle, and you know, it's actually all over the country. That's like these vegetable forward restaurants are everywhere. I just went to one tonight. I can't tell you what it is, but places like Clever Rabbit and Bad Hunter. And this place from New York called Little Beet Table. They're all doing just these vegetable forward restaurants. There's some meat on the menu. And it's funny because there's actually a little known city ordinance that requires every one of, if you have more than 70% of vegetables on your menu, you have to put a burger at the bottom of the menu. They all have burgers. So there's these mostly vegetarian restaurants that have like a big, like a double cheese.
That's like one councilman's like goes in front of the alderman, city council's like, there needs to be burgers down here.
Yeah, that was Burke's ordinance.
That's right. That was both Burke's. Yeah. All right. Let's do this. Can you stick around after the news and we can talk about what your favorite restaurants are right now?
Yeah.
I realize we should, while we have you here, and we can talk about what you should go eat this summer. Mike Sula is the restaurant writer and reviewer and critic for the Chicago Reader and the Chicago Sun-Times, and he joins us here on Industry Night tonight. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. Mike, you'll love this. Buddy Matt Klein, who did the nickname segment last year on the show, he just texted and said, I just did Google image searches of the noodles on the Yindi menu.
Oh.
I would never have tried the delicious pan cow guy without the visuals.
All right.
So there you go. I don't know if he got it right, but he tried.
Good enough.
Good enough. Mike Sula, restaurant reviewer and critic and feature writer for the Chicago Reader and the Chicago Sun-Times in studio tonight. You know, we're going to talk a little bit, and then Glenn Mercer is going to join us from the Feelies coming up after the break. You know, I didn't want to leave here without talking about what you think the hot places to go are in Chicago right now. Because, I mean, beyond just sort of what you can get from, you know, what's the high-end places to be, Chicago has new stuff, but also some favorites. And, you know, if this is a treat to Download Nation that Mike can share some of his favorites for the summer. What are you thinking?
Yeah, I've got two new-ish a sort of essential summertime eats that I just recently got hip to. I was in Chinatown late last month on the first really hot, sweaty day of the year. And, you know, it was the middle of the week and it was dead. It was like a ghost town. The restaurants were empty. There was nothing going on. I looked down Wentworth and there's this group of teenagers all hanging out outside this ice cream parlor called Legend Tasty House that opened in the really inconvenient month of June, but you know, in January, but in June it's
yeah,
packed.
It's perfect.
And
you
know, you walk in and everybody is standing in front of the counter with their phones up, Instagramming the people working behind the counter. The easiest comparison to make is Cold Stone Creamery. You know, they're working on a marble slapping the ice cream around. These are steel metal pans, at 20 degrees Celsius, and they're pouring this, liquid custard on like a crepe and maybe taking a piece of fruit or some cookies or something and smashing it into it. And they're taking those metal spatulas and spreading it around and flipping it and chopping it up until it starts to crystallize into ice cream. And they spread it in this thin layer, and they take the spatula and they roll them up in these sort of 4-inch-long parchment scrolls and stand them up in a cup and put all sorts of garish flair on them, like gummies and whipped cream. And it's this summertime ice cream treat that just seems like it's made for Instagram. And it's delicious. It's like subtly sweet. You can get like your chocolate, your mango, your strawberry, but you also get weird things like avocado and durian. And, you know, it's no Mario's Italian Lemonade, but it's kind of a little phenomenon right now. And
What's it called again?
It's called Legend Tasty House.
Legend Tasty House on Wentworth in
Chinatown.
That's a good one. All right. Mike comes through with one. What do you got for another one?
I highly recommend people go to the Daily Plaza Farmers Market on Thursdays and direct yourself to the southeast corner of the plaza. There's a place called Baked Cheese House in the German spelling. And what they're doing is raclette sandwiches. Raclette is this this you know, stinky French or Swiss cheese that comes in big wheels. They have these half wheels set on this contraption that's like a stand, and there's a heat lamp over the flat side, and there's a guy there who has who has like a large split baguette in one hand with maybe some ham lying down it, and he takes this cheese wheel and he turns it at an angle and scrapes this molten lava flow of cheese onto the sandwich, squirts it with Dijon mustard, and hands it over. And the people just sort of stand around this sign like zombies waiting for their sandwiches. It's really it's like a fantastic sandwich. It's just really incredible. So yeah, those are the two places.
Yeah, huh?
I think so. Summertime.
I love it.
Uh-huh.
I love that it wasn't some hot hoity-toity place on Randolph.
Yeah, well, there's those two. There's a few of those too.
All right, good. Mike Sula, a restaurant reviewer, critic, feature writer for the Chicago Reader and for the Sun-Times. You can catch him. He's an award winner. He won the James Beard. I keep saying that. This piece that won, the squirrel piece, it was fascinating. The way I explained it earlier in the show and got some attention, some people texted in about it, was that it's illegal to cook. Is it illegal to eat squirrel or catch squirrel and eat squirrel?
It's illegal it's illegal to trap squirrels. In Illinois, there is a squirrel hunting season. You can shoot them. You cannot shoot squirrels in the city of Chicago.
All right.
I can't tell you how I got my squirrels, but I got them. It's a long time ago. But you know what? The mayor sent me a really nice letter congratulating
me.
So I think I can use that in any case against me. I'm going to just produce that as my get out of jail free.
Was the idea of the piece to see it, to sort of push back on the rule, the ordinance that says no trapping squirrels, or was it to really see, feel what like taste a squirrel and put it into
a dish? I mean it really is. I mean, there are there are a tremendous number of squirrels that live and die every year in the city of Chicago. It's just extraordinary. It's actually like sort of a sustainable meat that you could, if you're good enough, you could survive on, if you had to. I was just sort of exploring that idea of like what is acceptable protein to eat. And, I concluded that squirrel is perfectly acceptable.
There it is.
It's Mike's, delicious, too.
That's a good story. You can still find it on the Reader, I'm sure. Mike Sula at the Reader and the Sun-Times, my guest tonight. I was just getting used to the mask. I was just the Mexican wrestling mask that Mike is wearing.
I can keep wearing it.
Good. Great to see you, man. Thanks for coming.
Likewise. In. Thanks, Justin.
Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, the Pitchfork Music Festival is just around the corner. The festival takes over Union Park on the Near West Side. And this year, the headliners include Solange, LCD Sound System, and A Tribe Called Quest. And on Saturday, Chicago welcomes back the Feelies. Feelies hail from New Jersey. They started their new wave careers back in 1976. They quickly became college rock darlings through the 80s with albums like Crazy Rhythms and The Good Earth. The band went on hiatus in 1992 but got back together in 2008. They also released a new album this year called In Between, their first in 6 years. Like I said, they're going to be at Pitchfork this year playing on Saturday. Glenn Mercer is the guitar player for the Feelies, and he joins me tonight. Glenn, a pleasure to have you on the Download. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me.
For you to come play Pitchfork, to come back to Chicago, talk about the memories you have with the Feelies of playing Chicago.
Well, we played back in 2010, I think it was, Millennial Park. That was a great night.
Yeah, right.
A lot of fun for that. prior to that, we had come to Chicago pretty much on a regular basis and always had really good time, really good crowds. So we're really looking forward to it.
To be on stage in Chicago as part of the Pitchfork Music Festival, there's going to be a lot of kids there. There's going to be a lot of people that may not have been around for your movement when you guys were the darlings in the 80s. Talk about that. Talk about playing to different audiences, what that means to you as an artist.
Well, it's rewarding, and you want to have a band that feels vital, and that includes putting out new music and making new fans. So it's not really about nostalgia, although we realize that's an important element. It is for us as well. But you don't want it to just be about nostalgia, so that includes spreading your fan base and getting some new people to get into the band.
You know, let's talk about In Between. I mean, the sound is different in the sense that it's slower. It's a little bit easier pace. But talk about the evolution of your music, because, you know, there's not too many bands that I know that have disbanded in 1992 and got back together decades later. Is the process similar than when you guys got together back in the late 70s or the 80s to the way that you produce music and record music to what you do with In Between?
Well, there are similarities. There are a lot of things that are different, too. The one thing, the major aspect is that Bill lives in Florida. Brenda lives in Pennsylvania, so we don't play nearly as much as we used to. We don't get to rehearse and jam as much as we'd like. Recording, once we get going, it's really not that much different. In particular, this new record we did at my house. So that pre-production-wise meant kind of making demos and taking our time with just getting everything together and getting the equipment together and a lot of pre-production on this record, probably more than other records. But once you hit the record button, it's really pretty much the same. Just set up and play pretty much the way we do live and, you know, take it from there.
When the band's not in the same place, what's your process? I mean, is it a lot of mail stuff? Are you just sending MP3s back and forth? Or are you trying to find a date on the calendar that you can all come together and record at the same time?
We exchange recordings through the mail, actually. We don't do MP3s. We just make CDs and send them through the mail.
As a musician and as someone who records and produces them, do you like the process of sharing collaboratively through the United States Postal System?
It's okay. I don't really put a value judgment on it. I guess it is what it is. I don't see it as being any better or any worse than any other method. You know, it's sort of like you can enter a room through the door or through the window. It doesn't matter as long as you get into the room. So,
you know, you've talked a lot, and reading past interviews, you talk a lot about the idea of producing this record from your home studio. You just mentioned it as well. How important is it for your music, the Feelies music, to have that personal touch? What I mean is, you know, you guys spent so much time together in New Jersey, I believe even in the house, rehearsing at a different time in your band's life. How important is it and how interesting is it for you to have your home play a role in the music?
I think it's real important. I think records tend to reflect, even in a subtle or often unconscious way, the environment that they're made in, and songs likewise sort of reflect the environment they're written in. You know, to have that all sort of tied together, I think, and the fact that we really tend to want to take the songwriting process through the whole, you know, all of the steps that includes the writing, the arranging, the producing, the mixing, the mastering, the artwork. So it's sort of, it's good to be able to do it all sort of in-house, I guess you would say, really.
Yeah. We're talking with Glenn Mercer. He's the guitar player, of course, co-founder of the Feelies. The Feelies coming to Pitchfork Music Festival. They're going to play on Saturday. It's great to have you guys in Chicago and playing at a festival like this. It's well-deserved. Looking back on your career, and you talk about, we talked a little bit about the late 70s and 80s, when you guys were putting out records like Crazy Rhythms or The Good Earth, and you know, you go back and you look at the top 40 albums of all time when it comes to the scene at that time, and you guys are on there. But you also disbanded in 1992, and our friend Jim DeRogatis in town talks loudly about how you guys paved the way for a lot of what happened in alternative music in the next decade, but you weren't around to reap the benefits. Do you think about that? Do you think about the idea of you laying the groundwork for a generation that took advantage of it?
Not really, no. We're kind of removed from, you know, evaluating our place in the history of music. Sort of could be detrimental to think too much about it, really.
There's a lot of bands that came out that did a lot of, I mean, I think of bands that had your sound that were able to benefit off of more radio play and more mainstream acceptance of the music in the 90s, especially when more formats on the radio seemed to go in that direction. When you think back to those times, was there enough support for your music in the 80s? Was there enough radio play? Were there other places that were doing the kind of stuff that we saw that become more common in the 90s?
You know, on the one hand, you had college radio played a big part and just fostering really the alternative scene, I guess you could say. And then consequently, the potential for that became so big that the major labels started to look at that and, you know, thought, well, how could we tap into that? And they started signing bands. And I guess there were unusual or a little bit, you know, the expectations were a little high on both sides, the bands and the record companies. And it's probably a little bit not realistic. It just sort of, I guess, it had its time and place, and things change and come and go and tastes change. You know, I guess a lot of the bands that we were like our peers and playing at the same time, we all signed to major labels and we all broke up shortly after that. So
yeah, right.
It wasn't meant really to be anyway.
I think of all the artists now, and there's some artists in Chicago that are having such success just being independent, without record labels, being able to use it themselves, use the internet in ways that other artists have never been able to do before. Do you wish there was that kind of apparatus when the Feelies were coming up in the 80s? You didn't have to count on a major label to essentially get your music out to a bigger audience?
I don't know if times are better now or then, or, you know, I really don't compare them. There were good things about then and good things about now, and the downsides of each decade. And you just kind of make music, make ourselves happy, really. You know, success is could be measured in a lot of different ways, so it really depends on your definition. And we always felt we were successful in that we were able to do what we wanted to do and the way we wanted to do it and make music that we were happy to play.
To come back and come back to Chicago and have a chance to play places like Millennium Park, and then also turn around and play Pitchfork Music Festival, as you just said, you know, you're not judging it by career, but as a musician where you use music to make you happy, what does it mean to play these big places in Chicago to have a space on stage for the Feelies?
Oh, it's great. We feel blessed in a lot of ways to be able to still have a strong fan base, really, and a lot of different opportunities to come our way. So we're really happy.
Glenn Mercer, of course, the co-founder of the Feelies. The Feelies are going to be on stage at the Pitchfork Music Festival on Saturday. Also, the new album that just came out this year, In Between. Glenn, a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks so much for joining us on The Download tonight. We appreciate it.
Oh, thank you very much. Pleasure's mine.
Great to have the Feelies on. One of Pete Zimmerman's favorite bands of all time. You go to his house and he's taken all the LPs and he's made that into a quilt. I don't know if that worked. Really uncomfortable quilt, but he's got them all. It's Pitchfork week here on the download. Coming up later this week, I think we're going to do it tomorrow or maybe Thursday, Hamilton Lighthouser, who is the frontman for the Walkmen, who now has a new album, one of the best of 2016, with the dude from Vampire Weekend. It's awesome, Rostam. And he will be playing as well at Pitchfork. So always great. I love when Pitchfork Week comes through because we get a chance to talk to some good musicians and people who are, you know, either old school or new school, have a chance to vary it up. Last year, I remember one of my favorites was Jeremiah. And it's not Maya, it's my, Jeremiah. He was playing Pitchfork last year. We got a chance to talk to the R&B star who is from Chicago. That was awesome. That's whenever I see Jeremiah like on the BET Awards or like doing something where he's just, you know, like just the guy singing on a, you know, someone's track. I'm always like, yeah, download. That guy called in one time. I got to get him in studio, right? Get a big table.
Oh, yeah.
Sit down for an hour with the crooner, Jeremiah. Anyway, that was last year's Pitchfork. This year, some great people. So we hopefully get some more people in this week as we celebrate the Pitchfork Music Festival. Thank you, Rob. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. All right. We're with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Amy Guth and Jen Bosworth are in for Patty Vasquez this week. They will be coming up at 11 o'clock. But right now it's time for Studio 435, our weekly showcase of the best live music Chicago has to offer right here in our Michigan Avenue Allstate Showcase studio tonight. The punk rock sounds of Chicago is so pretty. Their latest album is called Suck It Up, and they're playing downstairs at Subterranean Wicker Park on July 31st. So pretty is Ashley Holman, Rachel Mantard, James Seminara, and Stefan Lindgren. And they are in studio now. You guys, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Thank you.
So where does So Pretty come from?
The name of the band?
Not even the name. I mean, where's the band come from? Tell us about the origin story of the band.
We've
explained that like a million times.
But it's a good one. It's a good one. Me and Ashley were both playing separately with the same person, and it was not moving in the forward direction that we wanted, and so he just was like, you know what, you guys should meet each other, because you both have the same thing in mind.
You have ambition.
Have ambition, and you want to do things.
And
oh, man.
Very, very impatient.
And you're very impatient and pushy, so please meet each other. And so neither of us, we were just singing with them, and so we both sat down in her small studio apartment and learned guitar together, and we were like, we're going to start a band.
I think because if it would have, like, by the time we would have convinced someone to get off their butts and actually do any work, like, we were capable of learning a guitar, which tells you, I mean, probably what our guitar skills are like, at the same time also telling you, like, how lazy some other musicians can be.
I think I would take the latter point, just about when you talk about musicians in Chicago or even songwriters or people who are getting together to rehearse, to put music together, to arrange it, to produce it, all that kind of stuff. Yes, a lot of times the great ideas are sidelined by lack of ambition, procrastination, things like that. I think I come more from the comedy side, but there's so many people who'd be like, we got this great idea, but we'll deal with it tomorrow.
It never goes anywhere.
Yeah. And it's interesting that, like, the reason that, you know, you can have this town, I think, is great for all sorts of artists is the fact that if you want to execute, you can.
Yeah, and I think the biggest thing, too, is, like, finding people that are willing to commit to, like, half of the struggle in being in a band is getting 2, 3, 4, 5, however many people in a room at least once a week to play music together and not, like, kill each other. I mean, we're really lucky because, like, everybody in the band has, like, ties that if severed would mean this band would never go on ever again.
That's true.
Rachel and James are brother and sister.
So that's just not an, I mean, not really an option.
Yeah.
And then Stefan and I are dating and have been the entire time. I didn't like hook up with the drummer. I was already with the drummer.
We brought him in. Well,
I kind of convinced him because he was my boyfriend. I'm like, I really need a drummer and we can't seem to find a female drummer.
Well, wasn't the idea that you guys were temporary to begin with?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I was one of those lazy musicians at that point. I was like, you know, I really want to keep playing because I've been doing it forever, but, and now I'm busier than I ever have. So it's, this is delightful. It's great.
I was just trying to sell them some bass lines, and now I'm fully invested, and I've lost a lot of money on it. So.
We were cautioned when James came in. He's like, I can't really commit to more than maybe a couple months. And that was like 2.5 years ago.
Best stories. I mean, you wanted to set out to do an all-female band.
Yeah.
That was the idea, and these guys came in. Why did you want to go that route?
I think one of the reasons, this is just me personally, I think I wanted to work with women because I had only been working with men up until that point, and I was just frustrated. I think that was just honestly what it was. I was just tired of working. It wasn't for a gimmick. It wasn't because I, you know, don't enjoy being around men or that I don't like working with them. I just had gotten so frustrated. Yeah. And working with Rachel was so effortless and easy. I figured if I could just find like two more
two
of you,
more. Yeah, exactly.
That would be great.
And as far as the effortless part, that's where me and James came in because we were like, oh, okay, well, we learned a few songs. And then, you know, like I learned a few songs. We're like, all right, well, why would we change it now? This is fun. Yeah. And that's been the main thing with us for a long time.
When you talk about frustrations, I mean, what are you talking about? I mean, is it just guys sort of mansplaining music, being rude? Like, I mean, take us through. I mean, I think for a lot of women who might be listening who are in music, they're probably shaking their heads, but there might be a lot of people out there that aren't musicians that don't know what those frustrations might be.
I think for me and Rachel, she has her own frustrations. You wanna take that first?
I'll
head up after that.
I mean, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of frustration just in terms of going in, and a lot of the men that I've encountered just feel like they know more. And so I, like, my thoughts and my opinions of where I want things to go kind of take a back seat in terms of like, well, that's a great idea, but let's do it this way. And I'm like, but that's not how I want to do it. And so then that's just kind of a frustration of like it's poor communication. And then just like this whole overarching tone of like, that's cool, but I just want to hear your voice. Like, just be pretty for me for a minute.
Yeah.
Like,
okay, gotcha.
Yeah. Yeah.
My biggest frustration, and I mean, this pours over into like working with any kind of musician, because I know women that can be like this too, but I find that me being a woman and dealing with male musicians is this constant like, you need to do it this way because this is what's good.
It's the right way to do
it.
The quote unquote right way to do it. Now, if a man was doing something that he just instinctually thought was what
was
he wanted to make.
Yeah, right.
Even if it sounded bad or it sounded different, it would be innovative. If
it's
a woman does it, it's interesting.
Right.
It's new. It's not what everyone else is doing. And but when a woman does it, it just is. It's considered she's incompetent with her guitar, her instrument. She doesn't know what she's doing. She just doesn't practice enough. She doesn't care. And I think that's ridiculous. Like, if I'm doing something that other people around me aren't doing, it's not necessarily because I'm not good enough to do what they do.
Right.
I could sit in my house every day and practice exactly the same way they did, but then I would sound exactly like them.
Well, that's part of, I mean, you hear that from the greatest musicians who will talk about their craft is that when you get four people together, it's about how you all come together and the chemistry of what you individually bring to a group effort.
Yeah.
So the idea, but you also hear the other side where there might be one person who's like, this, I wrote all this stuff and I want you to play it this way. I mean, some of the great bands, even Chicago bands, are like that. But I mean, most of the time it's about the creativity and the chemistry that comes out of a group
and
playing together.
I think that we really like hold to that chemistry because we are so like involved with each other and so close, like, you know, that we will individually write something, but we don't come ever to the table of like, this is your part in this song, this, do this. We're like, well, this is kind of what I have. What do you guys want to add to it? What do you think? Let's go in a direction. And so really just using our chemistry to create the songs. And so they're not just a single person's song.
Well, let's talk about the sound. Because I really enjoyed it today, listening to Suck It Up. The I kind of explained it earlier in the show of this really interesting combination of melody and screaming. You know, this idea of you guys are doing, you know, the sort of, I would say the punk part, but the pop melody of it is there and you hear it. And then just really a lot of like screaming, like the more sort of punk aesthetic.
Yeah.
Where does that come from? Where'd you guys land on that kind of music where you're doing, combining those two things into one sort of music genre?
Well, probably one of the biggest reasons why we ended up doing that is Rachel, especially, and James, their mother is a vocal coach who's been doing that for...
Ever.
She's, forever.
She's been teaching. I mean, she used to teach here in Chicago. She's, like, singing operatically. She's, you know, she's...
It's been her whole life.
It's been her whole life is music.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if you're working with someone who has the capacity to sing, I mean, in almost any way you could ask her to, which is awesome. I think that's what, like, most people, if they're working with musicians, they want them to be that good. That's where that kind of came from. And I love to scream. Like, I am a very angry person, but I don't present that way because I'm able to get it out through my music. Like, and that is something that I think is important to punk music, but I think it's just important to music in general that instead of trying to force something that you're not, just to like listen to what is your voice.
Right.
That's my voice. I'm always gonna sound like that. You
and
know?
that's at the root of punk music. This idea that, you know, the sound and the message kind of play first as over some of the more technique stuff of like, this is a melody.
Yeah, I think sometimes like people go one like too far in each direction. Like you get punk music sometimes that there's no melody, there's nothing discernible about it, and then it starts to sound really kind of all the same. Like a lot. And then you get music where people are screaming where you're like, okay, this all sounds exactly the same. And then you get the singer-songwriter kind of genre where you're like, oh my God, this all sounds the same. And, you know, we have, everyone in the band has like really intense love for different genres of music. That's why when you listen to the album, people have described it as sounding like a mixtape, but it's the same band.
Well, and it's kind of helped me and you like singing together a lot because I remember at the beginning of like starting to work together, sometimes she'd just be like, Rachel, you don't have to hit that pitch exactly. Like you don't have to like be as like perfect as you've always like sung your music. And, for her, it was like rubbing off of like, you know, like, yeah, we can harmonize, we can do some things. And like,
there's
so kind of like
stuff.
Like bringing each other to this like nice medium that we both bring our voices like in our to ourselves.
Yeah.
Rachel Manter, Ashley Holman, James Seminara, and Stefan Lindgren in studio tonight. They are the band So Pretty. The punk rock sounds will be on display right after the break. We'll play live here. The album is called Suck It Up, and they are going to be playing at Subterranean in Wicker Park on July 31st. All right, we'll take a quick break.
All right.
We'll come back, and we will hear some live music in Studio 435 from Chicago. So Pretty. Stay with us. All right, I think we got it. I think we got the sound check. All right. Sounding good, guys. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. All right. In studio with us right now, the punk rock sounds of Chicago's So Pretty. Their latest album is called Suck It Up. They're playing at Subterranean coming up in Wicker Park on July 31st. They are here. They are Ashley Holman, Rachel Manter, James Seminara, and Stefan Lindgren. They're all in studio. We're going to hear, what's the name of the song?
Blueberry Blues.
Blueberry Blues.
Yeah.
All right. Blueberry Blues. All right, Studio 435, take it away.
Ready, guys?
You wanna know?
not swept out by jealous wind. But I'm telling you, no, you'll never win. I wanna be punk rock.
Chicago's so pretty in studio. The punk rock band playing Subterranean on July 31st. Their latest album, Suck It Up, is out now. Come on back to the table. That was great. And it was even better watching the people on Michigan Avenue watch you guys play. An amazing performance there. Thanks for doing that. That was awesome.
I like to think half of our appeal is our live shows.
Oh, for sure.
It's a treat to watch you guys. I mean, you're so passionate about it. I mean, talk about the experience of performing a song like that. I mean, obviously, it's pretty. That's a pretty classic punk sound.
Yeah.
But for you and the way you approach it physically, how do you approach that?
Well, I've been told before that, like, people who, like, listen to our record sometimes, like, don't get it. They're like, I don't understand why a lot of people, like, want to come see us. And then when they come see us, they're like, yeah, I get it now.
Oh, for sure.
For our second record, our engineer, Rob Makrowski, before we knew him pretty well, he actually came out to see us about 5 times in a row to prepare for our second recording. Yeah. He had already recorded us once, and he's like, yeah, that was good. But for the second record, I have to be able to capture the live sound of it. And I think he did. He spent, like, a lot of time doing that, and we're really appreciative of that.
I think to prepare for, like, live shows, especially, like, this is just my own personal, like, routine, is a lot of the songs are about being angry about, like, injustice and ignorance and things that happen, and that happens on a regular basis. And so I'm always imagining the person that day that's really just pushed me right over the edge where I'm like, I can't believe I'm having this discussion again with somebody, but like I definitely can use this tonight when I step on stage.
It's the motivation.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Tonight was the cab driver for sure.
Oh, yeah. Who almost took me out on Grand Avenue. So that was my fault.
I think it's funny that because when each of us sing a song, we all do it very differently. And like with Ashley's stage antics, half the time she's off stage. So, I mean, she's running around and she's getting the crowd involved. And then when I sing, I'm almost glued to the microphone, but I'm freaking out trying to get away from it. My sister's got much more of a just kind of laid back. Like she is just romanticizing the microphone and making everybody fall in love with it. I mean, Stevan's behind the drum kit, but you can see the intensity in his eyes. And I mean, that's just singing when I'm playing bass, I'm falling over practically. And
pulling out chords, yeah. Falling
oh,
over
gosh,
each other.
Oh gosh, yeah. How many times?
Like we always like tell people when they come to see our shows, we said this to you and Kip, it's going to be interesting. Like it might be a total circus in not a good way, but it will be entertaining to watch. And I feel like people don't do that anymore. You go to see live shows and you're like, man, they look so bored up there. Why are you so bored to be doing something you should be like loving so much? And if I'm not going to be able to play every note perfectly or hit every note perfectly, I really want to be able to entertain people.
Well, I mean, it is. I mean, at least that song, and we'll hear some more coming up here in Studio 435. Chicago's So Pretty is live tonight. But that, I mean, that's just a front punk song.
Yeah.
You know, I could hear the drum. I mean, it was like trying to, like, I turned the headphones up in here because it was just like, the Michigan Avenue was shaking.
Shaking. Like,
you know, but I mean, but when I hear it, and we'll talk about it because I want to get to the news here, but a lot of your music, I mean, it goes there, but it also has this juxtaposition, this contrast where you'll maybe start with almost, it sounds like a sort of picking folk song. Then turns into a punk song, or you know, you play a lot, like I said, with melody. So we'll talk more about that. The band's So Pretty in studio.
Some melody next.
The melody's coming up. The band will be at Subterranean Wicker Park coming up on July 31st. Ashley Holman, Rachel Manter, James Seminara, and Stefan Lindgren in studio. Thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman in studio for Studio 435 tonight, our weekly showcase of the best live music Chicago has to offer. The punk rock band So Pretty. They're going to be at Subterranean Wicker Park coming up on the 31st of July. Their latest album is called Suck It Up. Ashley Holman, Rachel Manter, James Seminara, and Stefan Lindgren in studio tonight. They're ready for another live track. Here is the song Think Again. Take it away, guys.
I want to be able to think again. I want to be able to breathe. I want to be able to feel again. I want to be able to scream. Hit a brick wall, coming home. Now we're out here on our own. Lost a feeling, lost a part. How'd we get so torn apart? That I could say that'll make this go away. But I can tell that nothing's right, 'cause you don't fall asleep at night. Don't. I would give just to heal, 'cause we are broken, we are diseased.
No! so pretty in studio here in Studio 435 and 720 WGN. They will be at Subterranean coming up here on the 31st. Their album's called Suck It Up. Ashley Holman, Rachel Manter, James Seminar, and Stefan Lindgren in studio. They are back on the microphones. Again, I mean, this is, you kind of said it, like the idea of a mixtape.
Yeah.
That song is night and day from the song that we heard, the Blueberry, Blueberry Blues, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But, I mean, talk about that. Talk about, I mean, you guys seem to go out of your way to be creative in the different approaches to the music. They're not all the same. It's not consistent punk rock or alt rock or whatever you have. There, you can feel the difference in the song.
As Ashley said earlier, all four of us are very, very eclectic in the music that we listen to, first off, and also write. You know, I think all four of us will get an idea in our head after we hear some certain song or some weird noise on the street that inspires us, and that's never the same. You know, you could be listening to, I don't know, a guy busking on the street with an acoustic guitar, or you can hear, like, train tracks going and you think of a metal song or something. Like, we're all weird in that way that it never sounds the same because our daily lives are never the same.
Yeah,
you know,
true. Yeah.
What's wonderful too is we've got a couple songs where all of us collaborated on the lyrics for, you know, mostly with the music parts. You know, I'll write my own bass line. They'll write their own guitar parts. Stefan just magically pulls drums out of nowhere. but with some songs, we've all written lyrics together. And so it's bizarre because we write incredibly differently about subject matters and about just rhyme schemes and all of that. But those songs we wrote together are so far off from each of our individual pieces.
Yeah. I think as a group, one of the things that we do have in common, even though our musical tastes are not exactly similar, is that we are all, like, very validating for one another.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think anyone in this group from day one and even to this day has ever been not support. I hear horror stories about bands and how crazy people are with their music and how not adaptable and supportive they are of their bandmates. And I'm like, I can't imagine getting together with people every week to have to do that. That would be a nightmare. That wouldn't be fun. And when
there's a
I
lot
bring
of competing personalities
to,
and things like that.
Yeah, right? When any one of us brings something to the table, everyone else is like, yeah. I mean, when Steph brought this next song that we're going to be playing to the table, and he's like, I want to put slide guitar on it. Not the next song. We're going to play it later on. But I'm like, I don't know how to play slide guitar, but I'm sure I could figure it out.
But there's a spirit to that. I mean, and when you think of being a musician and approaching music in a certain way, how much of it is about the aesthetic or the spirit or the philosophy and how you approach it? Because it seems like it's more than the instrument or the craft, but it's about the yes and, the chemistry, the ability to be emotional, like you said, like be angry if you need to be, vent some of the things that happen to you in the day. How important is that stuff versus, you know, the idea of music class?
I think that's the most important.
Yeah.
I think that, because the musicality can come. That's something that you can learn. I think if you're not the type of person that can be honest and vulnerable and open and to trying new things and doing everything that you can to be honest when you're making music. And honesty means also being okay with not being the best. If you can do that, you will be a good musician, quote unquote.
Quote unquote. Yes.
It's hard to be a perfectionist.
It is exactly like that. It is honesty, and it is therapeutic for all of us in there. I think that's something that we would encourage everyone to do is, hey, you don't know how to play a guitar? Pick up a guitar and go play it on the street. Go book a show. You know, you don't have to have it perfect, but, you know, to be music and to be an outlet of yourself, actually. And, you know, music's for everybody.
I wanted to get back to, we're talking with So Pretty, the band, the punk rock band from Chicago playing Subterranean coming up on the 31st. We got one more live song we'll play after the break here. But before we get there, you guys mentioned up at the top of the interview that you were looking for an all-female band before you guys settled on the thing. And what I found interesting from the interview that was in the Tribune was it wasn't that you couldn't find those musicians. Mm-hmm. You know, because automatically the question I would have is like, well, why couldn't you put that together? It's because that women in Chicago, especially in the Chicago rock scene, mm-hmm. they're in high demand, meaning there are a lot of musicians that are playing in Chicago. There's not that they're not playing. They're just, everybody wants to have a band in which a woman is involved.
I think some people do it for the right reasons. Mm-hmm. I think some people do it because they realize, like, putting it, I don't think it's tokenism, but having a voice in there that isn't just always saying the same things as if you have an all male band is important. But I think some people use it as not necessarily a gimmick, but as a way to entice people into saying, like, look, we have a woman in the band, we're enlightened. And that's always true. I think that happens. But and the unfortunate thing is you get all of these incredible female musicians who are playing wonderfully but not being taken seriously. And that is the unfortunate side effect of always being like, okay, we need a woman in the band. Instead of just being like, she's the best drummer that's actually around. We should have her in the band.
As two women who are part of the music scene here in Chicago, I mean, you mentioned at the top the concept of, you know, sort of why it's frustrating to work with men, a lot of musicians. Where do you see, I mean, is it a strong scene for women musicians? Is Chicago a respected place for it? I mean, do you see more of your sort of examples as opposed to the ones that you mentioned at the top?
Yeah, we've definitely played with a lot of other female bands, and we found that, I mean, we've been on a couple bills where it's all, like, me and her are the only women on the entire bill all night, and those actually aren't fun shows, you know? Like, I mean, they can be okay, but, like, it's just, it's a different vibe, and, but then the majority of our shows, there's other women around, and those shows are just fun, and that's really the majority, is that there's a lot of women out there now that, you know,
Chicago is a really strong is a very, very strong, more so than a lot of other places I've heard. Like, Steph lived in LA, and
if you want tokenism, you can go there.
James just got off like a month-long tour with another one of his bands, and, like, has been kind of all over the U.S. and I'm sure that he saw his share of, like, places where there's, like, no women at all playing music. But I think Chicago has a really strong base for female musicians. Just in general, it's a lot. I think it's a lot easier. Or maybe we've just had, like, a pretty decent run of good luck.
Well, I mean, let me ask you about punk rock, you know, because there'll be Chicago's had such a tremendous history with punk rock, and both the bands that have played here, but the audiences that have supported them. When you think of the breakdown of, you know, male to female audience members, I mean, there are a lot of women that come out to So Pretty shows.
We get tons of women.
But I'm interested. I mean, do you think that there's
We get all women, like, mosh pits at our shows, which is awesome.
We are also very, very active in getting, like, supporting women around us. Like, at a show, a woman's like, oh my God, that's amazing. That's cool. I just learned guitar a year ago. You want to, like, come to our house, learn guitar with us, like, and just supportive of other women, and, like, tell, like, they're allowed to be there. They're allowed to do anything they want. They don't have to, like, we've heard, like, in the audience watching other bands, like, I just overheard a girl, oh, I tried to learn guitar once. I wish I could play guitar like he does. And I'm just like, you could.
Like,
you could.
And that's, you just, so and that's, much that's could. Your job. That's your job as being the musician on stage, is, like, to give, like, some, I don't know, maybe that's just me personally, but I don't feel like putting yourself in a position where you are, like, lording over these peasants who have come to watch you. Like, who, honestly, like, who enjoys that? Like, the minute that someone says something to me about, like, how great they think our guitar playing is, or how wonderful we sound, or something, my first instinct is to be like, oh my gosh, you should come over to my house, and you can take one of my guitars, and you can learn this,
join
and
in.
You can be on stage. Because starting a band is not hard. It is not hard.
You guys show up. The band friends are like, Ashley invited 16 people to join.
Well, that's happened.
What we did is we have a song I wrote on ukulele. And so a bunch of women that were coming to our house for Skillshares, we taught them the ukulele part and had them come on stage with us and play that song with me.
With one of our biggest shows. Yeah. With one of our bigger audiences. And also, with, like, a really, like, nationally known, like, act.
That's awesome.
All of these women were like, you really want me to come on stage? I'm like, yeah.
Let's do it. I love it. Yeah. So Pretty in studio tonight. The album Suck It Up. They're going to be at Subterranean in Wicker Park on July 31st. Ashley Holman, Rachel Manter, James Seminara, and Stefan Lindgren. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We will play one more song here live in Studio 435. So stay with us. Mm-hmm. right, She's Real, She's Chicago, she's Robin Baumgarten. Watch Robin and the rest of WGN Morning News Team weekdays 4 to 10, Chicago's very own WGN TV. All right, it's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. It's time for Studio 435, our final song tonight from the punk rock band Chicago So Pretty. Their latest album, Suck It Up. They're playing at Subterranean in Wicker Park on July 31st. So Pretty is Ashley Holman, Rachel Manter, James Seminara, and Stefan Lindgren. James, moving over to lead on this one. I'm excited about this. I was just told the punkiest of the punk rock songs we heard tonight. And the noisiest. All right, here we go on Studio 435. This song is called Don't Give Up the Ship. So Pretty.
Well, oh my, my, the bank's just called. He ain't gonna make it through the fall. You hear those bastards laugh as they hung up. To them, this home is just a house. I play my game of cat and mouse. Oh, don't open the mail, best not test your luck. And pay those debts to them. A hot sheriff's claims are the damnedest thing. A watch don't die after it sings. Not a rocket can kill the queen. And never gonna find the name. You a break, just rip you off. All sounds good on paper, full steam ahead. And old big brother might lend a hand. Better shake twice for a payment plan. Wanna make an honest wage, you're gonna have to beg. Sit down and learn your place. That's all they ever taught in school. I worked so hard to be a scapegoat. Your chickens come to roost, get your ducks in a row. You're gonna go broke if you keep up the code. You know that.
So Pretty in studio here, Studio 435, the punk rock sounds of the Chicago band that features Ashley Holman, Rachel Manter, James Seminara, and Stefan Lindgren. They are going to be at Subterranean coming up on the 31st of July. Their album is called Suck It Up, and there you go, man. That's punk rock music as it should be done. I can't thank you guys enough for coming in. Thanks for being
thank
in
you.
Studio 435, and good luck with the show on the 31st.
Thank you
very much.
That's going to do it tonight. Coming up tomorrow night on the show. We're excited. The Download in Chicago Business will be back. We'll be talking with the CEO of Spot Hero. It's been a great run here in Chicago. And then also Professor Al Genie, our resident philosopher. We'll talk about the seven virtues. We did the seven deadly sins a couple months ago, and now we're going to be doing the seven virtues, how to be a better person. Amy Jen.
Hi.
Awesome to see you guys.
That was like one word.
Yeah.
Amy Jen. Amy Guth, Jen Bosworth.
Hi.
In studio. Good to see you guys. So you guys are in for Patty tonight.
Yeah.
Tonight, tomorrow, Wednesday, and Thursday.
All right.
That'd
awesome.
Be four nights.
Yeah, it's on.
It feels good, so like to have a consistent run when you're doing a sort of fill in, right?
Indeed. Yes.
The one off suck.
Well, it's fun.
I mean, suck is a strong word.
We had a good, but like, well, I guess we were on twice. We had we had a crossover session.
Well, so we were both on 4th of July, like during the fireworks. I was 7 to 9 for you,
for
and
you.
Then she was 9 to 11 for you.
Oh, nice. Okay.
And so I was like, okay, there's no guests coming in on 4th of July at 9 p.m. So why don't you give me an hour and I'll give you an hour and we'll just call it epic crosstalk.
Oh,
so that's what
go.
We did,
that's
and it was really fun.
And it was successful.
Fun. That's
apparently.
Fun.
Yeah.
Super
All
fun.
Right. Well, I got to go back and listen to that.
Yeah, it was fun.
Yeah.
Well, I think a highlight was the Wayne's World anniversary was happening. And so Guinness, the Book of World Records, was out in Aurora to break the record for number of people headbanging simultaneously.
That's right. I saw that.
And so I said, if anyone's out there, will you please call us? And we had this wonderful woman named Jane call us. And she kept calling. Like, she was texting and calling and giving. She became like the Auroran headbanging correspondent
for
the night.
Jane,
it was
the
so
headbanging
awesome.
Correspondent.
It was great.
That's good. All right. So now tonight, what do you have tonight?
We have so much to talk about. We have a filmmaker coming.
Mm-hmm.
She's going to come in and talk, and she's bringing a bike messenger with
so
her.
She made two movies about bike messaging in Chicago, and she's bringing a lady bike messenger, and I'm sort of obsessed with bike messenger culture.
My roommates in college were all bike messengers.
It's a wild ride.
I know. They got a little too crazy.
Literally.
They got a little too crazy.
Yeah, some of them, it's a wild scene. Let's just say that.
It's a wild scene. Yes, indeed. All right, so talk a little bike messenger.
Yeah, we're going to do that. We're going to talk about, there's this really cool, fun story from Thrillist, and it's kind of the backstory of all these iconic movie props that are totally bizarre and weird and like, ooh, that's made out of what? Ew.
Yeah.
And whose hand was that? Ew. Like, there's all this weird stuff. So we're going to be talking about that and just all kind of
all
fun
right.
stuff.
That sounds good.
Yeah. All the things.
All right. Well, have yourself a good show.
Thanks.
We will. So it is now just about 11. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNradio.com. If you're an Amazon Echo user, just say play WGN Radio. It is time for the news. And who is that?
Oh, who is
it? Oh, Rob Martyr.
It's Rob Martyr.
It's
Hi,
Rob.
Guys.
Hi.